get it because I see you.
Okay, we're going to get started. We're just running a little bit late this morning. We've all forgotten how to do this. But it won't be long, and we'll be back. So get yourselves ready. I'm Vicki Walker, your chair of the Senate Natural Resources and Alternative Energy Committee. Proud to be a senator for the state of Oregon. Proud to return as a senator from the state of Oregon. And very glad to see you. Senator Starr is with us this morning, but he stepped out for about an hour for a meeting. And you see all the rest of us wonderful and beautiful people up here. Judith is our committee administrator, and Aaron is going to be our committee assistant today. And we've got a pretty full agenda, so we're going to get started. It is a work session. There are some folks that we're going to have come up and testify. We've already notified them, and we've got a little time at the end for anyone who just wants to sort of have a few minutes to talk about whatever they want to talk about. So we'll get started. The first thing we're going to do is hear about LC 664, the Heat Smart Bill. So I think we are hearing from Andy Ginsberg from the department. Come on up.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator with DEQ. And I know you have a packed agenda today, so I'm going to go through this really quickly. I'm here to talk about LC 664, which we call the Heat Smart Bill. And this is designed to reduce wood stove emissions. And the reason we're doing this is that wood stoves are a significant source of particulate pollution in Oregon. So I'm just going to briefly show you this picture. The strand here is human hair. And the little chunk on the left of it is a grain of fine sand. And the little circles on the hair are what we call PM10. Those are fine particles that are 10 microns in size or smaller. And on the PM10 particle, you can see a bunch of PM2.5 particles. Those are called fine particulate. They're particles that have 2.5 micron diameter or smaller. So we're talking about these very, very small particles. And the reason we're concerned about them is they get very deep into the lungs where they can cause health effects. EPA has established national standards for particles. In 1987, they established a standard for PM10, and that standard was set, as you can see, at about 150 micrograms per cubic meter. Back at that time, we had 7 areas in Oregon that violated the standard, and in fact, we had some of the worst violations in the country, where in a typical winter, we would have hundreds of exceedances of the standard. We put together air quality plans that included all sources of particulate emissions, but it focused a lot on wood stoves. We also had requirements for industry and requirements for road dust, and we brought all those areas into attainment with the standard. Then in 1997, EPA came out with the PM2.5 standard, the first version of it. And the reason was that they found out that smaller particles were more dangerous because they get deeper into the lungs. Fortunately, at that time, we didn't have any areas that violated the standard because our earlier plans to meet the PM10 standard were also helping with the fine particle standard. But then just this year, EPA has lowered the standard again. Now the standard is 35 micrograms per cubic meter for fine particles, and we are expecting to violate that standard. This is a picture of the state of Oregon. The bars show the air quality. The red line is the standard, and you can see that a number of areas have air quality that's worse than the standard. We're going to have at least 2 areas that will actually violate it, and a number of other areas that are close to it. I just want to point out 3 quick things on this slide. The first is, of course, that we'll have some areas violating the standard, and that brings with it federal requirements for new clean air plans. The second is that you can see the blue line on there. The blue line shows the level that EPA Science Advisory Committee thought was a level of particles that would cause health effects. The red line is where EPA set the standard. So the area in between they won't actually technically violate the standard, but those places will still have health effects on the public. And when EPA looks at the standard again in 5 years, most likely we'll see it lower. That's sort of what I see here. And that tells us we should be doing things in all these areas to lower the air pollution and, you know, prevent air pollution and hopefully avoid violating the standard in the future. And then the last thing you can see from this slide is that not all of the areas have 4 bars. And what that means is that we've lost monitoring resources. All the areas where you see less than 4 bars is where we've lost monitors due to cutbacks in federal funds and also cuts on the state level. So just at a time when we've got the new fine particle standard coming out, we have less ability to tell how clean the area is.
Can I stop you about
yes.
that question right there? Do you have a policy option package to add monitoring?
We do.
To those folks?
Okay. Yes, we do.
Thank you.
This chart shows what we can do about the fine particle pollution. If you look at the second from the left bar, that's the emissions from a wood stove, an uncertified wood stove. Back in 1984, DEQ adopted the first wood stove certification program in the country, and we put it into place in 1986, and then 2 years later, EPA picked it up and set a national standard modeled after our rule. So now all wood stoves that are built are much cleaner, and the green bar, the third from the left, shows what the emissions are from a certified wood stove. So you can see a huge reduction in emissions from an uncertified stove to a certified stove. In 1991, we banned the sale of used wood stoves in Oregon. So all new stoves that are installed in Oregon today are certified stoves, or they may be even cleaner pellet stoves or oil or gas heating. But we have no requirement to remove the existing uncertified stoves, and those stoves last for a long time, and that's the problem that we're dealing with now, is that we've got a lot of uncertified high-polluting stoves that are still out there. So we've proposed the Heat Smart bill to do two things. One is to accelerate the removal of old stoves, and the second is to close some loopholes in the EPA wood stove certification program. So in removing wood stoves, we've got two approaches. The first is an incentive program where we're requesting basically a grant program to help especially low-income people and especially people who are in those areas that I showed you that are over the standard or over the health levels to remove their uncertified stove and then purchase a cleaner form of heat, maybe a certified stove, maybe a pellet stove, or maybe something else. The program would be funded by using penalties that DEQ collects for violations of open burning and asbestos work. So essentially, violations of air quality standards in the community would go back to the community in the form of cleaner wood stoves.
Is there enough money in that program? Are there enough violators to fund the grant program?
Senator Walker, in the last biennium, we assessed about $420,000 of penalties. So we can't predict what the future would hold. But if it did stay at about that level, that would give us a reasonable amount of money to be turning over the wood stoves.
Okay.
We also requested a small amount of general fund as seed money for this, because the penalties obviously will come in over time. The program is set up so that local governments can implement it if they like, and we have several local governments that are very active in wood stove prevention programs, and they'll probably want to run the program themselves, so we would essentially allow them to run it under criteria that we would set up. Other local governments that didn't want to run it, then DEQ could run it, and it would be set up to be flexible in that way. So that's probably the most important piece of this bill, would be a fund to help especially low-income people get into a cleaner form of heat. The second thing is a really a longer-term strategy, and it's kind of aimed at preventing problems with when EPA is going to lower the standard again in the future. And this is a requirement that when a home is sold, any existing uncertified stove would have to be removed at that time. We have currently several local governments that have ordinances that already require this. The city of Bend did it first, and they've now removed about 80% of their uncertified stoves just by the turnover of real estate. And now in the Medford area, a number of communities have already adopted an ordinance like this, modeled on the Bend ordinance, and several others are considering them right now. Klamath Falls is also considering an ordinance like this. So it's the time to do it when the home is changing hands. There's money available to replace an uncertified stove then. Then there's three loopholes that we want to close in the existing law. The first one is that EPA has a list of exemptions for stoves that are not required to meet their certification standards. When the program started many years ago, there were just a handful of stoves that were exempt. Today there are 261 types of stoves on EPA's exemption list. The picture on the left is a certified stove. The one on the right is an exempt stove, and you can't tell the difference between them. It's a technicality based on how much air they mix in or how hot the stove burns, and it just falls outside of EPA's definition of a stove. And we've essentially encouraged manufacturers to build on certified stoves that are exempt by allowing this to be this loophole to exist. So the bill would essentially close it, give the Environmental Quality Commission the authority to set standards for those exempt stoves, and we'd have the same standards.
So you mean to tell me, leave it to a manufacturer looking to make money, but you mean to tell me that even though those were not exempt, just limited to exempting stoves that were already in existence, those are just exempt flat out and they keep making them?
Exactly, Senator Walker. Those are new stoves that can be built today that don't have to meet the standards.
Wow.
The second loophole we want to close is for outdoor wood boilers, which are also exempt from EPA's program. This is a problem that's just beginning to emerge in Oregon, and we'd like to nip it in the bud before it gets to be a big problem. My colleagues in Vermont tell me it's a huge problem there. These stoves are used, you can see they're in a little shed out in the backyard. They have heat exchangers on them that are used to heat water, which heats the home. And one outdoor wood boiler can emit as much as 22 certified stoves. It has a very large firebox, and it's big enough that people not only can put whole green logs in it, but they can also throw their trash in it and anything else that they want to get rid of. These units are very inefficient, and there's a movement starting nationally to set standards for them similar to the certified stove program. So the bill would give the commission authority to adopt regulations to certify these stoves as well. And then the last loophole is to prevent the burning of prohibited materials in fireplaces or wood stoves. These materials are already prohibited to be burned outside in a burn barrel or a burn pile, but it's a loophole in Oregon law that doesn't actually prohibit them from being burned in a fireplace. So technically speaking, you could put plastic or treated wood or garbage or asphalt tiles in your fireplace, and this would just prohibit that. So it would make the list the same inside and outside as far as what can't be burnt.
Well, but the question is, how do you regulate that?
Well, that's a great question. And we wouldn't have a program to go out and inspect homes, but on a complaint basis, if we had, say, neighbors saying that their neighbor is burning tires in the fireplace, we would be able to ask them to stop. And, essentially just creating a level playing field with the inside and outside burning.
And you would do some kind of an education program?
It would be an education program, exactly, and a complaint response.
Okay.
And that's all I had today. The bottom line is that we need to take action to reduce the particulate pollution, meet the federal standards, protect health in about a dozen Oregon communities that are over the levels EPA Science Advisory Committee is concerned about, and the Heat Smart Bill would be the primary strategy for that, because wood stoves are the largest source of particulate pollution during the winter when we have violations. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. And the draft committee is LC 664 that was just handed to you a few moments ago. Does anyone have any questions?
Mm-hmm.
Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, I think in all the bills we're going to be looking at this morning, most of us haven't had a chance to see them or read them yet, or we've only got them a day or two ago. And this is for bill introduction primarily, is my understanding, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to give a caveat that I will be supporting these bills as I understand them, but that this is just to get them in the pipeline. And we'll have a chance later to really go through them. There's always devil's details, or we won't have a chance to hear complete testimony on them. And so I'm reserving my right to have discussion later time, but I don't want to slow the process down. So
mm-hmm.
a bill like this one, you know, on its face sounds like exactly what we should do, especially living where I do. In the Medford area, we have huge problems. And when the weather gets the coldest, it gets the most stagnant, and we have real problems down there. So I'm in support of it. But I will have a caveat here that I want to hear from manufacturers and public and others on this. But I certainly won't stand in the way of getting these bills into the pipeline with bill introduction.
Yeah, Senator Bates, that's pretty true. I think of every bill we're going to introduce today, these are not set in stone. These are just bills that we want to get in the hopper and start working on. And, you know, there's probably something we want to change in all of these, most certainly. But these were the I think these were a good starting point, and that's what we'd like to do today. Senator George.
Thank you very much. The wood boilers, anyone who's investing in a wood boiler is spending a lot of money. And I was thinking of a senior citizen, retired World War II vet, that cannot physically haul the wood into the home anymore, and he's thinking about buying one of these, and it's a major investment on a limited income. If we do put something in there about these boilers, is it going to be possible to retrofit them in an affordable way so that the whole unit will not be lost? Because it would be devastating to folks who have invested in them.
Chair Walker, Senator George, the requirements would apply to new wood boilers before they're installed. There would be no requirement to retrofit. Now, we may later on go back and try and, through a grant program, help people replace or upgrade their boilers. But I don't know of any technology today to upgrade the existing ones. We're just talking with the manufacturers now about what they can do about building new, cleaner ones. So this would only apply to the new ones.
Okay, thanks.
Well, that's a good point, Senator George. I think we should look at retrofitting. These things are putting out 22 uncertified wood stove capability of particulates.
Can I have a follow-up question?
Can.
My understanding that these things can cost up to $10,000 or $12,000. Is that correct? You know what the range of cost is on them?
Chair Walker, Senator George, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. These are pretty large large units,
mm-hmm.
And they would be, you know, a whole home heating system.
Okay, great. Any other questions, Senator Bates?
And just two quick ones. My understanding is most of these that are less polluting are also more efficient. Is that correct? The newer ones that have been built, and so they have, you know, they have a higher temperature and they burn cleaner, but they also burn more efficiently. Is that true?
And Chair Walker, Senator Bates, that's correct. The certified stoves are much more efficient in addition to having lower emissions.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Are they significantly more expensive?
Well, you can't buy an uncertified stove anymore. They're not made. So I can't tell you what the price comparison would be. Probably the price went up some when they were initially developed, but at this point it's the only stove that's on the market. The issue we're looking at with the wood stoves is the existing, already installed, old uncertified stoves that we need to remove.
Last question.
Sure.
Some of the homes are being built with fireplaces still, and not stoves in them. And I know the bill, from this reading very quickly, looks like it starts to address that. How are you going to enforce with the number of builders across the state that fireplaces are being built in homes, or when homes change hands, those fireplaces get retrofitted or the new ones are built the way you think they should be certified? How is that going to be handled?
And Chair Walker, Senator Bates, this bill actually doesn't address fireplaces except prohibiting the burning of plastics and other prohibited materials in fireplaces. We did that because fireplaces are pretty much used for, you know, ornamental or ceremonial purposes, and they're not causing, even though they have high emissions, they're not used typically to heat a home, and so they're not used as frequently. And that's why the wood stoves, even though a fireplace has more emissions than even an uncertified wood stove, but it's not used all that much. So the focus really is on wood stoves because they're used for residential heating.
Thank you.
I use my fireplace about 6 times a year, mostly around Christmas.
Right.
One of the things that I was thinking when we were talking about the education program is that when builders build new homes with fireplaces, you can have a little sign with the circle and the slat. Don't burn plastics, this and this and this. It's sort of like in your recycle box. When your recycler gives you a list of things they don't want in there, that might be part of your education program. Okay. So, any other questions? So we're good?
Well,
we were. Thank you, Mr. Ginsburg. I think we're going to set this aside for the moment until we have a quorum that we can actually do something with these bills. We'll just take testimony and maybe deal with them all at the end. Okay, so the next one we're going to move to is LC 1855, which is the water quality permit holders. Okay, so we have two folks to testify. We also have Stephanie Halleck here from the department to answer any questions if there are questions that need to be answered. So I'm going to hear from Ivan Molesky first.
Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ivan Molusky, and I am the conservation coordinator for the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club. Oregon chapter Sierra Club has nearly 24,000 members statewide with a strong interest in clean water, healthy rivers, and a safe environment. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. I have had the opportunity to view the draft legislation before you today that would require the posting of signs and buoys at locations where permit holders discharge persistent bioaccumulative toxins into Oregon's rivers and streams. This type of legislation is critical in ensuring the public's right to know that what types of pollutants are entering our waterways and where this is occurring. As I mentioned to this committee before at your August 14th meeting in Newburgh, public concern for clean water runs strong. The public wants to know what pollutants are being discharged into our rivers, where it's happening, and what steps are being taken to stop it. In polling we conducted earlier this year, among diverse members of the public, we found that over 82% supported regulatory action to prohibit public sewer systems and private industries from dumping waste and heavy metals at levels above federal clean water standards into Oregon's rivers, with over 70% strongly supporting such action. We further found that 91% of Oregonians support a requirement that public notices be posted along rivers and streams in areas where such discharges occur, with nearly 80% strongly in favor of such action. It has become increasingly clear that concern for protecting Oregon's clean water is not a partisan issue. It is a value shared by all members of the public who love Oregon's rivers and streams, whether they use them for drinking water or for the recreational opportunities they provide. It is in this spirit that I'd like to encourage the committee to move forward with this legislation today, and thank you for your efforts in that regard. That being said, I will offer a few specific comments on the draft legislation. First, the focus on persistent bioaccumulative toxin is an important one. Toxic substances that accumulate in plant and animal tissues pose a serious concern for public health. And while heat and turbidity are also important threats to water quality, there is no real need to make them the target of marking systems where the intention is to inform the public of the presence of potentially harmful toxic chemicals. Second, it is important to more clearly specify that markers or buoys shall be required to be placed around the perimeter of areas where water quality standards are expected to be exceeded in a fashion that is clearly visible to the public. The current draft legislation appears to provide the DEQ with too much discretion in determining whether the installation of marking systems or buoys are feasible, which could lead to inadequate posting. Lastly, the current language of the draft legislation could be simplified to specify that the receipt of the permit to discharge will be the trigger that requires the installation and maintenance of marker systems. As written, there is a risk that marking systems may be delayed due to the DEQ's lack of water quality testing to determine whether each permittee's discharges are causing waters to fail to meet water quality standards. The DEQ does not currently do this testing, and even their own requested budget increases will not allow them to do comprehensive point source testing across the state over the next biennium. By issuing a discharge permit, the DEQ is in fact allowing dischargers to exceed water quality standards for specific pollutants, and marking systems should not be delayed by a lack of data and resources to test every point source that the DEQ has already permitted to exceed water quality standards. In conclusion, I'd like to offer a more general perspective on the broader issue of point source pollution in Oregon's waterways. Both the type of legislation before you today and efforts to provide full funding for a water quality monitoring testing program for DEQ are good steps in the right direction. In addition to these efforts, we would also like to encourage the legislature to consider appropriate actions necessary to compel the Department of Environmental Quality to begin employing strategies to actually reduce point source pollution in our rivers, not simply permit and monitor it. Again, thank you for the committee's efforts on this important issue today. We look forward to working with you in the coming weeks and months in developing solution-oriented policies to addressing pollution in Oregon's rivers and streams. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Molusky. I'd like to ask you a question before I turn it over to my committee. Your concern about the DEQ not being able to test the data and therefore we can't mark the area, would you want to change this draft in some way? It's my understanding lines 16 through 18, deleting a particular sentence might be helpful to you in that regard.
Not sure which.
Do you have LC 1855 in front of you?
I do.
If you go down to lines 16 through 18,
all right,
on the first page.
The system of buoys or similar markers shall designate the area where the waters fail to meet the water standard. That's a fine sentence. The concern I raised, Chair Walker, members of the committee, the concern I raised was that there's a lot of discretion given to the DEQ to determine whether the marking is feasible in the first place. And as this is written, there may be too much discretion to not post adequate signage that is clearly visible to the public. I know I believe that would be the intention of this legislation, but I'm not sure that as it's written, it clearly enough states that the DEQ has to make this clearly visible around the perimeters of the mixing zone.
Mm-hmm. So just simply deleting that sentence, isn't that going to work for you?
I'd have to double check that. I think there's a perhaps more comprehensive way we could state it. There was some language in last year's similar legislation that may be adequate as a substitute, and we can talk about that.
Any questions of the committee? Let me state that this bill, of course, comes out of the work from last session and the testimony we heard up in Newburgh, which was pretty extensive. And we tried to be sensitive to the comments that were testified to at that hearing and throughout the session, last session. So I think we're going to have a lot of work on this bill, but I think it's an important bill to have in the process. Senator Bates, you had a question?
Yeah, first I'm going to apologize for not being at Newburgh. I couldn't leave town that day. The language you've crafted here is a good start, I believe. I think the key to it is lines 12 through 15, where the DEQ has determined if water quality has been inadequate, and then that's when posting occurs. Just because there's a mixing zone doesn't mean there's automatically going to be posting. And also, it appears from my reading this also includes discharge from cities.
Absolutely.
And any other source. So it's not just aimed at, as it has in the past, the industry, which I think has done a great job in many areas of taking care of this problem. It also opens up the question that we tried to deal with last session and we didn't, which was really getting good, adequate monitoring of water across the state. And that's not really occurring anymore. It occurred back in the 70s and 80s, and defunding both at the federal and state level have eliminated a program we used to have. That program was statewide. It was systemic and comprehensive. And we don't have that anymore. And what we're talking about here is trying to look at spots we think might be a problem for us. But I would caution us that we should think larger. And we've had conversation with DEQ about what a program like we used to have would cost and what it would actually do for us. And I think we might want to look in that direction. It's really easy to have a tendency to point to certain industries or certain areas that we think are a problem. And miss the important stuff that might be going on elsewhere. As an example, a few years ago up in the Dalles, there was pollution going on from the point of view of pesticides getting into the stream. The DEQ inadvertently picked that up, found it was affecting fish, coho, especially eggs were being killed, traced it upstream to an orchard, and the orchardist who was involved didn't know it was happening, and he was very happy to work with the DEQ, changed how they applied their pesticides, and resolved the problem. It was a win-win for everybody. He actually ended up using less pesticides and saved money. That's the kind of monitoring we really need, not just aiming at this boogeyman of toxic mixing zones or mixing zones. So I would caution us to think a little larger, possibly. I had a talk with Director Halleck about this earlier in the year and asked her to put a larger program into a request for the governor's budget, and I have a hunch that didn't probably happen. But I would hope it would be something we can discuss as a legislative assembly. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. We are going to be discussing writing a letter in support of the policy option package for DEQ, and Ms. Halleck will be talking about that after we're done addressing this piece of legislation. And I have the same concern. This policy option package only tests water on the Willamette. And you were not in Newburgh to hear the very articulate and compelling testimony from the Umatilla tribe, but they have serious water problems in their area as well. So we'll talk about that in a few moments. And you're right about this legislation. I think it's extremely important for people in Oregon to understand what's going into their water and where. And cities, municipalities, they dump their sewage into the river as well, and I think we need to know about that. It's not all one particular industry, and you're exactly right, and that's why it's important to know where it's coming from. But I also don't want these signs being posted and listing the names of the permit holder and who it is that's sending this sort of toxin into the water, because that's not what we're about. We're not about in your face here. We're about trying to correct the problem. So if we just list the permit and the discharge, then people can go to DEQ and find out who that permit holder is. But you definitely need to know what you're stepping into when you step into a water area. Did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ivan, good to see you, and good to know you made it.
Thank you, Senator George.
We were talking yesterday about whether he was going to make it off the mountain when he went home last night, so good to have you here. You and I talked about the fact that back in 1999, when Senator Wild and I, and with the Committee on Agricultural and Natural Resources, began to look at this issue, and the thing that shocked us is just what Senator Bates said, and that is, we don't have any way to really know where. At that time, we couldn't even identify where the point sources were. We didn't know what quantities of polluted water were going in. We didn't know, of the 110,000 hazardous substances, how many of them are still in there and at what quantities. And we were promised back during that year that we were going to have testing facilities in the state of Oregon. And I think it's just about time, how many years later now, we're going to be going into the 07 and to actually have the means to know what we're doing to the river. I think it's time. Sorry about the commentary there. But
oh, I appreciate commentary anytime. Any other questions of our witness? All right, thank you, Mr. Molesky.
Thank
do you have
you.
Any parting comment? You look
would,
like
I,
you do.
I would like, if possible, Chair Walker, I'd like to respond to something that Senator Bates said, if
uh-huh.
that's all right. Senator Bates, or Chair Walker, Senator Bates, I respect your concern regarding some of the issues you raised in terms of we want to know that we're marking areas that are actually, causing problems. The concern that I was attempting to raise here in my comments was that, as you know, DEQ doesn't have the adequate funding right now to do sufficient above basic monitoring of point source pollution. Even with their requested budget package, they're going to still basically be maintaining a very basic level of funding. And this bill appears to essentially put these rules into effect, I believe, towards the end there on September 1st, 2008. There's not really a certainty that the DEQ will have been able to test the point sources out there that need to be tested in order to put these buoys. So that's really where our concern stems from, is that the mixing zone really, and the issuance of the permit really is the best handle we have right now on the possibility that water quality standards are failing to be met. And I would be concerned that if we don't require buoys to be posted in association with that permitting process, that there will be polluters out there that are discharging unsafe levels of pollutants that aren't being covered because there simply weren't the resources to go out and test. So it's a shared concern that we have with you, and that's why I raised those concerns. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Saperstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I brought a partner with me, and his goal is to try to keep me from insulting the committee. I'm Ralph Saperstein. I represent the Oregon Water Quality Coalition, which is a broad-based coalition of water users, and have been very interested in the mixing zone issue and other water quality issues. And with me is Rich Garber, and Rich works for Boise Cascade, and he's a technical environmental expert on mixing zones and all kinds of water quality issues, probably more things than that, but that should be enough. So, and he's going to protect me from saying anything wrong. We
you need protection.
Yeah, yeah. Now the chair may not agree with you, but I don't know. The coalition would be willing to work on this type of legislation. We would like to have been involved because, as Rich could describe, there probably are some real technical problems with trying to do these things. And based on Ivan's testimony, which I'll have to go back on the internet to rehear, but there's a big difference if the issue is marking mixing zones that I think Senator George pointed out, the large mixing zones he could see from his airplane due to temperature and turbidity versus the zone of initial dilution for toxics, because that zone most likely is to mark it is going to be down under the surface, and it's going to be extremely small because the toxics are released below surface water level, and so marking that will be a real difficult thing because by the time you would mark it on the surface, it would probably be the area the size of the buoy or whatever the marker turns out to be. Versus these large expanses, if those aren't the concern, the temperature and turbidity aren't the concern, then it's really a different issue. So I think we'd be very willing to sit down and work out details for exactly what the point of monitoring is.
Thank you.
Senator Walker, Chair Walker, and committee members, I would just like
can
to
you state
add
your name for the record, because I don't
yes,
think we
it's
heard it.
Yes, it's Rich Garber, with Boise Cascade Corporation.
Okay.
I guess on behalf of a regulated community member, a permittee, I'd just like to say that the DEQ has an excellent permitting process in place already, and these issues of mixing zones are very carefully looked at and evaluated. There's a very significant amount of testing that is required for a permittee or municipality, point source permittee, to go through and re-permit a source. And the issue of the zone of initial dilution and establishment of that, and also the chronic mixing zone, those are very carefully evaluated. In addition to the testing that's done, there's modeling requirements that are done. A significant amount of work prior to a public hearing where the public gets to comment on that. And to put in place a marker system to try to somehow show where this dilution zone is and mixing zone establishment is on a river body is really impractical.
Thank you.
And it seems to be more symbolic than substantive. And I think it raises potential concerns among the public, especially around municipalities that will not really serve a purpose. And I think the public has a very adequate chance to participate in the permit development and to comment. And I just would like to assure the committee that the DEQ does an excellent job of requiring municipalities and industrial permittees of evaluating their discharges, ensuring that the discharge is safe. I don't believe that the establishment of the buoy system or the marker system really serves a purpose beyond the excellent program that the DEQ already has.
Let me ask you this question, Mr. Darber. Mm-hmm. If you went to the Willamette River to go swimming, which I wouldn't advise, but if you did, and you went to a location that had a sign that said overflow sewage discharge for the city of Eugene, would you jump in the river right there?
Yeah, that's an unpermitted discharge, ma'am. The city of Eugene is required to meet their permit requirements, and during some kind of an upset condition, they're subject to enforcement or penalty at that point.
But they can have overflow during periods of high rain.
That's possible.
Wouldn't you want to know where that is if you're in the river?
During a discharge period, I don't think I'm going to be in the river during, I guess, a runoff period when that occurs. City of Portland had the same issue, combined sewage overflow. That typically occurs in the middle of winter. That's not a swimming season.
Okay, well, I found the testimony between the two of you a little bit contradictory, because Mr. Garber says, and I'll get to you in a second, Senator Nelson, says the DEQ already does an excellent job, buoy system and marking would not serve the purpose, and yet, Mr. Saperstein, you said you'd be willing to work on the legislation. So can you kind of, like, come together here on your two messages?
Well, Rich represents a corporation that has been involved in this issue. And as I said, I'm representing the Oregon Water Quality Coalition, and we are trying to convince everybody on both sides that there's an opportunity to look for some middle ground and resolve these things.
I thought that was what I heard.
Yes, and I also testified like that before the election.
All right, thank you. Senator Nelson has a question.
Thank you. This marking of the buoy, what I'm understanding is that there are times there might be discharge or times there's not discharge. So do you have somebody go out there each time and say, okay, there's take the buoy away if it's safe to be in there? I mean, what I'm saying is, what is the practical effect of this? How do you do this on the ground if you get to the point where you have to put a buoy in the river?
I think that's one of the concerns that I would have. These permits for both municipalities and private industry have been, they're primarily continuous discharges, and they've been looked at very thoroughly, and they've been found to meet water quality standards. And that's how the permit gets issued. And the discharge has been determined to be safe. It meets chronic and acute toxicity requirements, and that whole process is evaluated very carefully during the permitting permit issuance and during the public hearing.
Just to follow up, just a comment, I guess. I mean, sorry. I mean, if I was the public and I went out there and the sign that said shouldn't be in there, but actually the water was okay because this was a temporary discharge, then you would be depriving me as a public of maybe some enjoyment of the river. Just because the sign is up here and I'd be afraid to go into it. So how do we resolve that problem?
I guess from my perspective, the use of buoys, I think it creates undue concern. I think it kind of goes against the DEQ process, which says that we have looked at this and we have determined that this is a safe discharge. And that's the basis of issuing the permit, and that's the basis of the NPDES permit program, both federally and at the state level. So I agree with you that it does create a concern.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions down here? Senator Ringo.
Senator
Hello.
Walker, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Okay. All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. Senator Bates, did you have any questions?
Thank you.
Okay, great. Okay. Well, now that I have a quorum, let's step back for a moment. Let's go ahead and take this one, and then we'll go back to the wood stove bill. Gentlemen, this is we only have gentlemen on this committee. I'm the only woman. Okay. So,
but you are in charge.
Yes. Woo, I got the big stick. Okay. This, as you know, was an issue last session, and I think it's a continuing issue, as was clearly seen by the testimony we received in Newburgh, as well as the emails you've probably received and conversations you've had with people in your district. This may not be a perfect bill. There seems to be some concern still by industry that this is something that's not appropriate, that it doesn't get to the practical purposes, and I think Senator Nelson has raised an issue about that. Again, this would be a bill to introduce into the hopper so we can have a conversation about it in the legislative session. So I'd entertain some motion at this point, and then we can have some discussion. Senator Nelson, do you want to do this, or should I have someone else do it? I'm getting...
I'll just do it as a courtesy.
As a courtesy.
I probably should have somebody else do it. Okay. I move LC draft 50 or 1855, is that correct? 1855.
Right.
Introduce as a committee bill.
Okay. Senator Nelson moves LC draft 1855 should be introduced as a committee bill as a courtesy. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, I just confused because you were talking about wood stove and 1855. Yeah,
we're going to do wood stove after this. We talked about that before you arrived.
Okay. Senator Ringo and I are both on 664, so you threw us you
yes.
mentioned it in a second. Okay.
We're on the last bill that we just
gotcha.
Discussed, the Bowie
gotcha.
Bill.
I'd actually, if I may, just
yes.
I'd like to hear from the... Of DEQ. Did I miss some testimony when I was in and out?
No, they're here for questions, and we're under discussion. And if you'd like to hear from the DEQ, I'd be happy to have.
You've got two sides coming in here saying, you know, presenting their things, and I have a great amount of trust in the DEQ. It's kind of what people.
Oh, good. Ms. Hallett, can you come forward, please? Identify yourself and.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck. I'm the DEQ director, and I am definitely the second string on this issue. Lori Onan, the Water Quality Administrator, is first string, but I will do the best I can to answer your questions.
Okay, Senator Nelson, take it away.
I'm just, you know, here we've heard two sides of the story. I mean, I just want to hear another side of the story. I mean, your permitting process is pretty stringent. You have some pretty strong requirements and standards. I mean, is this bill actually going to do any good?
Senator Nelson, first of all, let me just comment as I'm sure you will appreciate knowing, the bill as drafted, there would be a fiscal for us. This is typically not a function that we perform. The Health Division actually is the agency within the state responsible for posting health notices when you know, there are notices posted about fish and things like that. Typically, the Health Division does that. So we would, if we were going to take on a function like this, we would obviously have to get up to speed on, you know, how one does it and does it appropriately and all of that. So it would be new for us. And as you've heard from others, we are proposing at this point to invest the resources we do have and the resources that we are requesting in other ways to deal with toxics. We do use the permit process, as you heard now. We would like to get resources to enhance what we do. But we do have a rigorous process. We are able to do some mixing zone review with the resources we have. Resources that we are requesting would allow us to do more. As Senator Bates indicated, it is a relatively modest request for toxics monitoring, and whenever you want me to get into what that request is, I'd be happy to do that now, or I can come back up after you've talked about this bill. So it's not a bad idea. It's a new thing for us. I think what the committee needs to wrestle with is, given all the pressures for funding and how we can spend our resources on dealing with the issue that we all care about, which is toxics in the water, is really this the best way to do that?
May I ask a question?
Sure, I am.
Okay. Ms. Halleck, if you look at the bill draft, do you have it in front of you?
I do.
Okay. If you go down to lines 18 through 20, it indicates that payment for installation and maintenance of the buoy or marker will be part of the permit fee application. So it appears to me that the fiscal to DEQ would not be as large as maybe you're anticipating, because the permit holder would be required to pay for that.
Madam Chair, actually, I have not looked at all at what the fiscal might be. I just saw that there was some rulemaking involved, and there would be some kind of a fiscal that we'd need to look at.
Right. Okay. Question, Senator Bates?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, the bill is written, and again, I'll make the caveat, I'm going to support these bills to get them in the pipeline so we can have a further discussion. The bill is written, as I understand it, says that buoys and markers will be only placed at areas where water quality standards have not been met. And that'd be your department's responsibility to make that determination. I would be moved personally to think that if water quality was not being met, that the public does have a right to know that. But simply having a mixing zone does not mean those quality has not been met. I mean, there's most mixing zones, as I understand them, the water quality is good. It's been met. It's not a danger to the public. So those would not require a buoy or a marker. Is that the way you understand this bill?
Senator Bates, Madam Chair, I can always trust Senator Bates to go to the heart of the matter, which is why when I woke up at 3 o'clock this morning wondering what I was going to say, I debated with myself about going to the heart of the matter. But since you have taken us there, I will indeed respond to that. That is precisely the intent of mixing zones. And so what the committee would need to wrestle with is, are we in fact, and Senator Walker alluded to this earlier, simply going to put a sign wherever or a buoy wherever that says this permit allows these things to be discharged into the water, and if you have a concern about that, you can go to DEQ and find out who it is and what it is. And it would not, as I understood Senator Walker, indicate one way or the other whether it was illegal or legal to do that. It's simply letting people know that it happens. Because Senator Bates is correct that a mixing zone, the purpose of a mixing zone is to allow for water quality standards to be met. Now, that said, we have an enforcement mechanism. People have permit conditions. They need to comply with the permit conditions. The monitoring discussion becomes critical, because most of the monitoring right now is done by the sources themselves. They submit daily monitoring reports to us. We review them, And if there are discrepancies in the data, which there are sometimes, we take enforcement action. And that's the way the system works now. But just having a mixing zone per se does not mean that a source is going to be out of compliance or not meeting water quality standards. So what would be noticed to the public is very, very important in this bill, because you don't want to unduly alarm people. At the same time, you want to give them information. And we do have in our monitoring proposal, in our package, part of it is to, in fact, create a web-based tool to allow greater access to information to people than we are able to do right now. And we totally agree that that's an important thing to do. But what you do, if you do something like you are proposing with the bill, I think it's very, very important for all of us to work on precisely what that looks like, what it is you are saying, and why you are saying it, and potentially when you are saying it.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My good friend Senator Nelson made the case that you don't want to unduly alarm people. I agree, totally. How do you balance that against not enough information where somebody could actually end up in harm's way at the other end? I mean, people do have a right to know if there's a toxic in that water. I mean, how are you going to arrive at that balance? I mean, you alluded to it just now, but how are you going to get there to have a balance? You know, you can't have a law this long written on the side of a buoy that's going up and down and people read it. I mean, you know, how do you get there?
Well, Senator Shields, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, I think the first thing, and we've talked a little bit about this, and that's what we're trying to get to with the legislative concept, is you got to have accurate information to give people in the first place. Now, the Health Division has a lot of information. It's been very interesting. We've actually been spending a lot more time partnering with them, and they already have a lot of information that they put out on the web, and they put out on brochures, and we have been creating more web links to them ourselves, because I said they have been the agency with primary responsibility for public health information, particularly around water quality and fish. So getting accurate information and providing it. The fact of the matter is, from legacy practices, from current practices throughout the state, there are going to be toxics in the water. And they're going to be in the sediment. They're going to be moving through the water column. They're in fish somewhere. I mean, we all know that. We're all concerned about it. We all want to do something about it. And our approach is in the policy package. Some people ask, and I'm happy to explain, why don't we have information? The reason we don't have information is because under the Clean Water Act, the system in this country for monitoring water was built on what is called ambient water quality monitoring for other pollutants, not toxic pollutants. So we actually do not have much of a toxic monitoring program at our agency, and other agencies around the country are in the same situation. We're building that capacity right now. We have some. We have had some in the past, but it's a completely different monitoring protocol. It's a completely different equipment, everything else. Our lab people could give you the particulars. So we have to get good data before we try and communicate to people accurate information. And that's the goal of what we're trying to get next session for this agency. We haven't had it. And so we work with the system that we have. We work with the Health Division. They do beach monitoring postings. They work in coordination with us on that. So I don't know if that's much of an answer to your question, but it's the best answer I can give you right now at this point.
Senator George.
Director, we sample constantly when we're processing, and water is totally contained and we know exactly what's going on. And it's a very, very basic little farm operation. And we have very, very sophisticated cities and with sewer treatment plants and businesses that are either dumping in ahead of going through the sewer treatment plant or having their own point source discharge. It appears to me that there's not a major problem in intercepting that line, and I was an irrigator for the bulk of my life, so I know how to move things around inside of pipes, to pull a sample out. And here's my question for you. Once you have that sample, which is representative of, you know, and you can do it on a multiple times per day, so you would have an average of what was actually occurring inside of that discharge pipeline, Once you have that in your hand, aren't there labs, sophisticated high-tech labs today, that can tell you exactly what's in there?
Absolutely, Senator George.
But we don't know that.
Senator George, you have to have the resources to take the sample in the first place, okay, and the resources to then do the analysis.
I started counting 99, 2000, 2001. It's nine fingers, guys. It's nine fingers. And you and I have talked about this issue, and I don't think this goes on any further. I really believe people have a right to know what's happening to them when they come into a river. We have a major promotion now of come to Oregon and enjoy the pristine Oregon. Is it? I don't know. And the answer to that is we should know. So, I mean, you'll know how my vote will be right now.
Well, thank you, Senator George. I was thinking that myself as you were speaking. And I went to Whitefish, Montana over the holidays and passed many beautiful rivers, the Clark Fork River being one of them. And I looked out at that pristine river and I thought, is that really pristine or is there garbage in there? I just don't know. That's the point. Senator Ringo.
Madam Chair, thank you. Director Halleck, I appreciate your position on this, and we had a number of conversations last session about this, and I would just remind you and the committee that last session one of the things we wanted was just a map, just identifying where the mixing zones were, and that wasn't available. We had to pull teeth, we were given promises, and it was delayed, and along the lines with Senator George's, I just think the waterways belong to the people of the state of Oregon. It may be okay that we allow people to discharge toxic chemicals, carcinogens, into public waterways, but at the very least, the public has a right to know what's going on. And I sympathize with your response concerning resources. You know, you can only do what we give you the money to do. But given the fact that this is a health issue, we are dumping carcinogens in the water. To me, it makes sense that we just give the public the information, even if it's inconvenient or at some expense to industry or to the department. So thank you. Thank you for your ongoing work on this.
Thank you, Senator Ringo. And as I said earlier, we absolutely agree on the need to give the public information. And as we've discussed before, I mean, that's a very key part of our policy tackling proposal.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes.
We obviously are going to take this up in session.
Yep.
And we can sit here all morning discussing it further, but I really don't want to. I think we might do it in session. I think we have consensus that we should move it forward. As a point of interest, I might add that for those of you who take National Geographic, there is a very interesting article in National Geographic about this very issue on a national level, and it's very graphic, and you might enjoy looking at it this month. But I would suggest, if we could, that we could move forward and ask the question, and we can move this forward and have a discussion in session.
I think that's an excellent idea. We have a motion on the table that's been kindly offered by Senator Nelson, and that is to move LC 1855 as a committee bill. So if there's no further discussion, let's take a vote on that, please, if we could.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Decker. Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Nelson.
No.
Senator Ringo.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
No.
Senator Beyer. Chair Walker.
Aye. Both Senator Beyer and Senator Deckard are excused. Okay, thank you. Ms. Halleck, we're going to have you talk about the policy option package in just a moment, if you just want to sit there or go back there or whatever. But I want to go back to the wood stove bill very quickly now that I have a quorum. Gentlemen, committee members, we are now on LC 664. We just had testimony a moment or two ago from the department about the need for doing something about our wood stoves. What I like about this is that, I think, did we add the income test to this?
There is an income test, but you'll want to look at this.
Okay, we'll want to look at this a little bit further during session. But I think this is a good idea to get in the hopper and take a look at. And Senator Nelson, can you be my vice chair?
Sure can. I move LC draft 664. Be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. Senator Nelson has moved that LC 664 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Okay. Can we have a vote on that one, Aaron, please?
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator
George.
Aye.
Senator
Nelson.
Aye.
Senator
Ringo. Aye.
Senator
Ringo. Aye.
Senator
Ringo. Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Byer.
Yes.
Aye. Okay, great. Thank you very much, committee. All right, I've asked Ms. Halleck to speak to you all about the policy option package that DEQ has for toxics monitoring, and that's really apropos since we've been talking about the LC draft we just had. So, Ms. Halleck, why don't you take us through this package and tell us what's in it, what isn't in it, in terms of, you know, do you have enough money to do what you want to do, and if you don't, what are you missing?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck, the Director of DEQ. This is a policy package. It is our policy package number 121, watershed-based toxics monitoring. This policy package would be $1.8 million of general fund. There would be 7.26 FTE to fund 10 positions. This is all new to DEQ. Those positions would be phased in over the 2 years of the biennium. Eight of them are associated with our laboratory, and two of them are dedicated to the geographic information systems and the provision of the web-based tool that I commented on earlier to provide information to the public. As Senator Bates alluded to earlier, and I think the gentleman from the Sierra Club did as well, this is a very modest, very basic program request. A full monitoring program at DEQ, not just for toxics but for all pollutants, would probably require an additional $13 million and about another 60 people to do a full-on, as Senator Bates uses the term, Cadillac monitoring program.
Did you say 60 people?
60, in addition to what is at the department already. So we have looked at the issue, and as you've heard this morning, talked with many people about how do we get some kind of an adequate toxics monitoring program at the department, and this is the step that we have proposed. And it would, in fact, as was alluded to earlier, begin in the Willamette Basin watershed, not just the main stem Willamette, but it's the whole Willamette Basin. And so the resources for doing the monitoring and gathering the data would be initially there, and then we would move from sub-basin to basin to sub-basin throughout the state over time.
Do you have a priority for in what order you would move around?
Beyond the Willamette, the program may have, I don't have it with me, but I can get that information for you. The policy package itself, the language only addresses the work in the Willamette sub-basin.
Okay.
But we would, I would assume we would use the other aspects of our program, what we refer to as the 303D listing of water bodies that do not meet water quality standards, our TMDL program that I'm sure most all of you have heard about, so that we would do some targeting of the areas where there was the most need. I mean, that's really the goal of the first assessment work, is to look drill down to where the problems are, so that since we have limited resources, we are using what we have in the areas where we really need to use them. And obviously a critical part of this is going to be coordinating with multiple stakeholders, with local governments, with the NGOs, with the tribes, and quite frankly, begin by gathering in all the data that are out there. I mean, a lot of people, and you have heard and will be hearing from a lot of people, have information. Tribes have some very good information, and we are aware that particularly the Umatillas are concerned that this package does not include the Columbia. We've been in extended conversations with them on the issue of fish consumption rates as part of the water quality toxic standard. So there's a lot of interest. They have some very good data. Probably would be good for the Umatilla area as well, Senator Nelson. So it will involve working with a lot of people, developing a good plan, and then just kind of marching through it.
Can you tell us, please, I think when I was reading it, and I had a couple of drafts in my hand. Oh, here it is. There's no page number, colleagues, but it would be 1, 2, 3, page 4, where it's on a policy package narrative. It says if this package is not funded, it lists what DEQ will not be able to do.
Right.
And if I might just sort of read that into the record, DEQ will not be able to develop a web-based tool for the public and DEQ to access information about toxic pollutant data. DEQ will not be able to collect and analyze samples for toxic pollutants in waterways, sediment, fish tissue, and groundwater in the Willamette, and you will not be able to identify where toxic pollutants are coming from. So
that's correct, Madam
without
Chair.
Without this policy option package, we get none of these things.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
I think all of us believe are important to Oregonians. Let me ask you, and colleagues, I've also included for you the letter and testimony from the Umatilla tribe that was very articulate and compelling when we were in Newburgh. That should be in your packet. From Armand Minthorn. And I'm glad, Ms. Halleck, to hear you say that you've been talking with the tribe because they felt that they had not been given due deference in the fact that they have scientists on board who know quite a bit as well. So you've been talking with them. If this policy option package will not impact them at all because it's not going to test the Columbia, but in the meantime, if you can get this up and running, you can continue to work with the tribe and those folks in other areas of the state who have water quality issues. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. And if I may, we are working very closely with the Umatillas in another venue and all the tribes in another venue, and that is with our Environmental Quality Commission. At the last Environmental Quality Commission meeting in Astoria, we had a meeting between the commissioners and the tribal leaders on the issue of fish consumption. We have made a commitment to revisit the fish consumption rate in the water quality toxic standard that we have submitted to EPA as part of the triennial review that is we're in the process of beginning now that is completed. This exercise will be working through till the end of 2008, and that is going to involve workshops, multiple stakeholder conversations. I have stated on record, the EPA acting administrator has stated on record, Lori Onan has stated on record, that the fish consumption rate needs to go up. Now the question is, where does it go, and how high, and what number? We increased it in the standard that we submitted to EPA. It was not increased sufficiently from the perspective of the tribes. No one disputes that they eat more fish. The issue is, how do you, on what population do you base a standard? So we are in those conversations. We have made a commitment. We have another policy package that requests resources to support our work on water quality standards. With or without that policy package, we will meet our commitment to address the fish consumption issue.
Great. Thank you very much. Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think about $13 million in getting this job underway, getting this job maybe even done. The first thought I had was, well, okay, if the legislature is not willing to pony up, do we have the ability? Do you have the ability to receive contributions? I mean, I think about all the efforts over the years, you know, in cleanup or reforesting the Tillamook and lots of things like that where, you know, kids were collecting pennies and nickels and dimes and people were saying, well, you know, I'm going to leave part of my inheritance to make sure this work gets done. Do we have a mechanism in place to actually receive contributions for a specific action like this? If not, what would you think about a bill that would include that?
Senator George, to my knowledge, we do not. We would need legislative authority. We have authority to assess fees for activities, mm-hmm. but that's different than what you're talking about. And I guess I'd have to think about that a little bit. I had not thought of that before.
Thank you, Senator. Mm-hmm. Any other questions, Senator Bates?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you take us back a little bit in time and outline for us the kind of monitoring we had for our water 15, 20, 25 years ago? Was it more robust than it is now?
Senator Bates, I can't take you back too far in time because I've not been there any longer than 18 years, and I started out in the hazardous waste program. So I do not claim to be an expert on that. But in general, as I alluded to earlier, the monitoring world was simpler, and we certainly, far before my time, had very robust efforts that resulted in cleaning up the Willamette River. And when you hear people talk about cleaning up the Willamette River, that is not a misstatement. The pollutants that were going into the river at that time, and this is what the Clean Water Act was created to address, were different than these kinds of toxics that we're talking about today. There may be some legacy toxic contamination from some of that pollution that we really weren't aware was happening, but we were able to get a handle on the problems easier and more easily, and the kinds of monitoring, and that, quite frankly, the state was not as populated as it is now, and the contribution to the pollution, we didn't have that many point sources, but either municipal or industrial, so it was a simpler world. So in a way, it's an apples and oranges comparison. But that said, over the past few biennium special sessions, we've lost about $20 million of general fund. Most of that's in the water program, and a whole lot of it was for monitoring. So, yes, in the big picture, our monitoring capacity has been very much scaled back, especially mixing zone review. We used to be able to do more mixing zone review than we can do now. I think we do maybe 15 a year, something like that. And our hope would be to boost that back up to at least twice that amount. So it's not a very precise answer to your question, but I don't really know. I could get you more precise information, but that's a general response.
Thank you for that question and that answer, Senator Bates.
Oh, what would be the cost of I'm not going to say Cadillac, a necessary, robust, and good evaluation of our water quality across the state, not just the Willamette River? Let me preface this by saying, back in the 60s and 70s, we saw rivers that were so badly polluted it was obvious to the people looking at the river that was polluted. You could light the river up with a match at times in some places in this country, and one river actually caught on fire. That motivated the public to move. What we're dealing with now are things we can't see that aren't obvious. The chair was on the Clark's Fork, and she knows that there are certain rivers in Montana that look pure and clean because they have arsenic in them, and it's killed everything in the river from mine tracing. So just looking at water no longer tells us if it's safe. We are seeing increased rates of cancer in our country. We're not sure where it's coming from. There's growing evidence that a lot of that's coming from pollutants in our environment. Having said all those things, what would be the cost of really a really basic, solid, systemic, overreaching, and reoccurring monitoring of our water in the state, above and beyond the package you're suggesting?
Well, Senator Bates, I didn't bring the numbers that I gave to you last time we discussed this, but I will do my best. And let me start by stressing, I don't want you to walk out of this room thinking that DEQ is not doing monitoring and not doing our job. We have, and this package that we are proposing would give us what I would refer to as a solid base monitoring program. They would total about that number that I gave you for a solid base. The other end of the continuum is what I alluded to earlier, which would be another $13 million and roughly 60 people to do a full bore across the state, all pollutants, all water bodies kind of water monitoring program. So in response to your question today, somewhere in the middle, I think it was something in the neighborhood of around $13 million and the equivalent FTE to that. So these are all rough numbers that you and I have discussed before, and if the committee is really interested in getting some precision to that, I want to do my homework and give you some detailed. I've worked with Senator Bates on this. We have my lab people did some excellent work for him last session on very detailed description, and I'd want to get that to the entire committee. But it is more than what we are providing here, but I don't want you to think that we are not doing our job for the citizens with what we are doing now and what we are asking for in this budget.
Thank you.
Thank you for an excellent answer.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. You mentioned the tribes have a lot of research. Have they ever actually done physical analysis of the fish they eat? What compounds are in the fish? Has there been any studies along those lines?
Senator Nelson, members of the committee, I suspect so. The issue with the tribal studies, of course, that is challenging for us is it's about tribes. And so it doesn't give us the data that they have, the work they have done for their fish consumption and the kinds of fish and what's in them is very, very good. And there's no issue with that data and there's no issue with their fish consumption. The problem we have is how do you extrapolate that information to the rest of the population? Ideally, for wrestling with this issue, and we've had conversations with EPA, and I think we're in process of trying to get some more money from EPA, we would have a Pacific Northwest evaluation of fish consumption, you know, for all of us who live here. Because that would really, in my mind, that would put the debate to rest because we would really know. Now, I understand from EPA that it would cost about $3 million to do a study like that. So we have talked to them. They actually, Region 10 EPA, has put in the National EPA Strategic Plan a priority. They have two geographic priorities. One is Puget Sound and one is the toxics in the Columbia River Basin. And so I said to them, okay, you guys put this in the National Strategic Plan. Let's put your money where your mouth is and let's go back to headquarters and get some money and get this data so that we can make an intelligent decision about fish consumption. But if you are interested in seeing the work that the Umatillas have done on this, I'm sure they'd be happy to provide you the, there's a couple of studies. Kritvig did one and then I can't remember the other one, but that is good. It's good information.
Thank you. I can get that. I know enough. But I just that when you talked about them, I'm thinking, well, we're talking about fish. The best way to do it is to check the fish that they're eating. What are the chemical compounds that are in there? I mean, actually physically in there rather than putting it on this kind of big scale. I mean, is there really an issue? Is there really a problem? I mean,
well,
they eat more fish. I know that.
Senator Nelson, one of the things, and here again, the Health Division does have some very good data about fish, the different kinds of fish and the pollutants that are in them. And as you may all know, again, I'm not a fish biologist, and I am the second string, but the ground fish or the bottom fish, those kinds of fish are the ones that tend to have more pollutants in them as opposed to the migrating fish or the salmon, and the salmon are the migrating fish. And so there are, in fact, different kinds of pollutants, different concentrations, depending on which fish they are. But I think the tribes will tell you that they eat a variety of kinds of fish, although the salmon, of course, play a very, very important role ceremonially and in their whole life cycle.
Great. Thank you. I wanted you to hear about the policy option package because I wanted to do something a little bit different that one other committee has done this interim. And what I'd like to do is ask that our committee support a letter to the Ways and Means co-chairs in support of the policy option package. And because I think it's critical in the discussion we've had with water monitoring, and clearly Director Halleck has pointed out the deficiencies that they have in their budget right now. So I just thought as a committee who's been studying this issue that we might be interested in having me write a letter as chair of the committee as you all supporting it in support of their policy option package. So I guess I would ask that question if you'd be in support of me doing that. Any discussion about it? Senator Ringo?
No. I mean, one of the issues on mixing zones is that there is a lack of information somewhat because of a lack of resources. And everybody agrees we care about clean water. There's a lot of difficult policy choices, and that having a policy option package, I think, can only be a good thing because it provides more information.
Okay. Any other comments?
Go ahead,
Senator Bates.
Okay.
I'm actually going to oppose this for a very strange reason, and Stephanie, you know what's going to be. I think we give the false impression that we're doing what we should be doing and we're not doing what we should be doing. I feel very strongly about this, both as a senator and a physician. I think we have an opportunity here to do the right thing. And I'm not concerned about throwing the good out for the perfect. I think we're making a mistake. This is a $13 billion budget. This directly potentially affects the health of Oregonians. We worry about pesticide use reporting. We worry about mixing zones. And we don't sit down and do what we really need to do, which is properly monitor the water in the state of Oregon. And so I'm going to oppose this for that reason. Not that I don't think it's a great package. It is what it shouldn't be doing, that your department isn't doing what it should be doing, because you're doing the best you can with the resources you have available to you. But I'm going to oppose this and say no to it. And I'll give you a courtesy yes if you need to get out of committee. But I'm opposed to this package because it's inadequate. And I don't want us fooling ourselves that we think we're doing the right thing.
Senator Bates, I appreciate that. Let me sort of clarify what I had in mind. This isn't a bill we're going to get out of committee. It's just simply a letter I wanted to write on behalf of the committee. But that letter would say that we support this policy option package, but we believe there should be more money invested in the program, as was testified in committee. To have a full bore system, it'd be $13 million. So if you, you know, I'd be happy to add that caveat into the letter, if that makes you happy.
It doesn't. And the reason is, I know how the co-chairs work.
Yeah, I know.
If you ask for 50 cents, you get 25.
That's right.
If you ask for 25, you get 15. This is too important an issue to ask for 50 cents, get 25, and we need a dollar.
That's a good point. Okay, and Senator Nelson.
I agree, it's a good thing. My concern this whole thing is looking at a bigger picture. Of all the committees and task force I've been sitting on in this session, my figure for asks is somewhere around $3 billion right now. they're all very good programs. You can't argue with them. I was in a technology committee Tuesday, and there's over $700 million. It's not all general fund, but there's $700 million for a very important... three projects that are very important, and from my view, the way we're going to solve this problem, and talking with Paul Warner, that the taxing system we have, it's going to be very difficult for us to change, regardless of how people think about that. I really think that's going to be very difficult to change. And the way we're going to solve it, this problem, and the way it's been solved in other states, particularly Western states, is the use of our natural resource. And I'm on record as saying that water is Oregon's oil. And we have a renewable resource that we are not using. And if we don't at some point get that resource dedicated, some of the resources of that dedicated public services and public funding, we're never going to be able to answer some of these problems. I fine to send the letter, but it's going to be caught in another $3 billion of asks someplace. And I'll support it from that viewpoint, but I do have some reservations that we can actually get it done.
Yes. Well, that's always our reservation. Oh, is there another comment down here? Okay. I'd just like to take a vote then and see if you're all in support of me sending a letter supporting this policy option package. And I'd like to put in there that certainly we would hope for a full bore system. Okay. Can we take a vote on that?
No.
Excused.
No, he's not.
Oh, he's here.
Would you just vote?
You should just vote yes.
You voted no, but you should vote yes.
Aye. You can vote except for me.
Aye. All right. Thank you, colleagues, for your support. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Halleck. We certainly appreciate that. And, colleagues, I do want to let you know that when I submit my letter, I will be submitting the testimony from the Umatilla tribe along with that letter so that other members can see the concerns that they have.
Madam Chair, if you're going to do that, I just want to point out one thing, and we are going to check in with the tribe. They alluded in their letter, I believe, to our $20 million request for water monitoring.
I did.
And I want to make sure they understand we don't have a $20
million. Yeah, I did notice that too, Ms. Halleck, and I asked Judith to check in with Armand to make sure that it was a typo.
And we will do that as well.
Yeah, and I'm almost certain it was a typo.
Thank you.
Because I thought $20 million, yeah.
Senator Bates wouldn't be voting no if that was
the case. That's exactly right.
That wouldn't be.
Okay, colleagues, thank you. Moving right along then, we are going to go to LC 1805, which is our biofuels package. So if you'll pull that one out. Oh, we have activity. And okay, yeah, and there are two attachments I want you to pick up in addition to that. One is the ordinance number, and there's no number, but it's an ordinance that the city of Portland has. And so if you'll pull that one out, and then there's an Exhibit A amended that's attached to that, and Commissioner Leonard is going to be testifying, and so you'll want to have those things at your ready reference. And I believe those are... Okay, so since Commissioner Leonard has to leave at 11, but I think we'll get done by then, and since he's a former member of this assembly, why don't you come forward and talk to us? And while he's doing that, colleagues, this is sort of it's a look-see at what we did last session. It's a look at what the governor's looking at. But it's also got some things in here as a result of our visit to Pendleton and our conversation with Kent Madison, who, if you recall, Kent Madison said that he would personally hunt down every single member of the legislature to make sure they wouldn't get reelected if we implemented a standard that could not be met in Oregon. And we took that to heart, and so we kept our, and Commissioner Leonard's going to be talking about what they have encountered in regard to that, but we did take that to heart, and we graduated the standard because we needed to make sure that we could grow the crop to feed the gas tanks in our state. So we'll take a look at that. So, Commissioner Leonard, welcome.
Good afternoon. Nice to see you, Senator Walker. And everybody. I've served with everybody here. It's really fun to come down and see you all.
Yeah. So tell us what's going on in the city of Portland.
Well, you mentioned Kent Madison, which is an excellent segue. Martha Pellegrino, to my right, my wife and I, drove back to meet with Kent, Al Grajak, and a host of Pendleton area farmers and leaders, including the mayor of Pendleton and a county commissioner. Maybe Senator Nelson remembers some of the names better than I do, but it was a great trip. It's actually the second time I've been to Kent Madison's farm. I was on a delegation under Representative Jensen when I was a member of the House. And we went back to Kent Madison's farm and did essentially the same kind of tour that we did about 3 weeks ago. We went there for two reasons. One was to make sure that the ordinance that we had in Portland meshed with Oregon farmers. As Al Grojak asked me very pointedly in one meeting, why did you pass this ordinance? Did you pass it because you're environmentalist? Did you pass it because you like biofuel? Or did you pass it to help Oregon farmers? I had never been asked that directly. And I said, we passed it to help Oregon farmers and to help the environment. And we want to benefit Oregon farmers first. So the second part of our trip was really to discuss with Al Grojak, Kent Madison, a financial relationship between the city of Portland and our fleet in the city and the Oregon farmers that grow canola converted into biodiesel. And what we learned, and part of the point that you were making, Chair Walker, about incenting Oregon farmers to grow their canola to make it is, and Senator Nelson and I have had some communication on this, is the farmers need to have some assurance that the price is going to be at a certain level.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some discussion about what that may be. Dave Nelson, being the great negotiator he is, has a very high price he thinks that is.
I just learned from Senator Bates. Senator Bates said, yeah.
Start high.
There's a place to start
high. Others think it needed to be quite that high, but there's a number in there that is the price, and we're working with the Pendleton grain growers to determine what that is. It's somewhere around 14, 15 cents a pound for canola seed. We are going to buy all of that before the ordinance is even implemented to fuel the Portland fleet. So, for an example, the Portland Water Bureau, which I have responsibility, now uses B99. To fuel all its diesel vehicles. Mm-hmm. Altogether, just the Portland fleet, aside from the ordinance, consume 400,000 gallons of biofuel a year. Not diesel, but just biofuel. So we're going to have a relationship with the Pendleton grain growers where they supply us as much of that as they can at a guaranteed minimum price, notwithstanding what the market price may be for canola on the open market, notwithstanding what the market price may be for a barrel of oil. But to get to actually have this initiative work, we have to put our money where our mouth is. We have to be able to say to the farmers in Eastern Oregon, we are not going to have you take the risk of planting a crop that you then can't sell. We understand that we have to guarantee you a price for that crop, and we're very close to signing a deal with Pendleton grain growers to do that. Mm-hmm. Second part on the ordinance itself, over and above the 400,000 gallons that the city will consume, will demand about 5 million gallons a year to satisfy. So our partners in Eastern Oregon believe that they can ramp up so that over a period of years they can supply up to half of that 5 million gallons that we're requesting that come from Oregon Farmers First. And we have written the ordinance, the version you have in front of you, you'll see, was written in a way to do a couple things that I think are different than what other states have done so far and what I think is being contemplated here, and that is to actually give preference to canola first. And the reason that we give preference to canola first, one might think, is parochial, that we're just, you know, blatantly trying to help Oregon farmers. And I'm happy that it does that. But we have to have, as you know, as council knows, we have to have a solid legal basis for doing that. And the basis for doing that is palm oil, which we've banned in the ordinance outright, which I'm happy to discuss through the reasons why, has the highest gel point of any of the sources for biodiesel. It gels somewhere around the upper 40s, early 50-degree Fahrenheit range. That's an impractical fuel, notwithstanding the environmental impact of just the clear cutting of the palm forest in Malaysia to get it. It's an impractical fuel to use in climates where it gets cold. Soybean also has a much higher gel point than canola. It's somewhere around the 32 degree Fahrenheit range. Canola, on the other hand, is anywhere from 0 degrees Fahrenheit to minus 5 degrees Fahrenheit before it begins to gel. So we feel real comfortable legally to give preference to canola first. To the extent, you'll hear some from the lobby, and there is a group that this ordinance doesn't help, and we might as well just acknowledge that. The petroleum industry does not like this ordinance. And being the excellent purveyors of the message that they are, instead of coming here and telling you they don't like the ordinance, they'll say, well, you can't supply the amount of fuel that Portland's going to require with this mandate. That's just not accurate. We've written it in a way so that it's very flexible in terms of their first choice is going to be Oregon canola fuel. If for whatever reason that can't make up the 5%, there is a plentiful stock of soy-based biodiesel that's allowed under the ordinance. And if for whatever reason that can't supply it, there is a provision in the ordinance for us to be able to suspend the requirement so that we only have as much as can be supplied. So it's very flexible. It was the ordinance, this draft that you're looking at, this final version, was done in two large work groups, including the oil industry, including Kent Madison was involved, Al Grozjak, the bio industry. I think it's truly an initiative that I mean, it's good for the environment, but it is fundamentally an economic development initiative for Oregon that starts in east of the Cascades, heads down the Columbia River via barges. The Port of Moro is very excited about this initiative because of the business this could generate for them. And then we're talking about building a facility on the Willamette River in Portland where this product will ultimately end up. So this is a way for Oregonians to be able to really be proud of when they go fuel up their vehicles, that the product that they're pumping into their vehicles, and I'm one of them, by the way, I drive a diesel Liberty, and it's pretty cool to be able to stick a sequential fuel nozzle into the car and know that I'm helping farmers, I'm helping the environment, and all the money stays here in Oregon. So that's kind of a broad overview. I want to be able to answer
it. Yeah, let me ask you that because I'm looking at your ordinance and it doesn't say Oregon-grown crops.
Yeah, it does not. What it does say is, and we have a companion ordinance that's not here that is very specific about why we've identified canola as the preferred stock. The issue in that acknowledges the lower gel temperature and also the transportation costs. Mm-hmm. So inherent in us identifying canola is, and in our criteria, is going to be those that respond to an RFP have to show us that the transportation costs, that is the amount of fuel needed to transport the product to us, is reasonable. And so no, it doesn't say that. You can't say that, as a matter of fact. But we think, in crafting this with the farmers in Eastern Oregon, we think we've drafted it in a way, though, that it, let's just say, it puts them on a pretty even playing field.
Yeah, that was my question on that. And I don't think that you can because of interstate commerce, because Washington State, as you know, has passed a very expansive biofuels bill, and they're getting more water out of the Columbia than we are. So they're able to grow a lot more of these crops, and I'm a little bit concerned, about that. So talk to me a little bit, Ms. Pellegrino.
Chair Walker, I'm members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino. I'm also with the City of Portland. Just want to make two points of clarification, and as the commissioner mentioned, canola is one of the crops. You'll notice that on the first page, where it says ordinance, there is no number because this ordinance, these amendments have not been adopted. They will be adopted. They will be considered by the council next Wednesday. So by then, this could potentially become the final ordinance. But if you look at number 5 under Section 1, that actually gives the scientific names for the feedstocks that that are being considered for to meet 50% of this ordinance. And so I'm not a scientist, many of you who have experience in farming understand this better than I do, but it's the genera brassica, which is a canola. Those are the mustard seeds. And then it also includes sunflower, safflower, flax, all crops that can be grown in Oregon and regionally. So to your question, Chair Walker, on the third page of the ordinance, or the third page of Exhibit A amended, there's a capital F, which actually explains that there's going to be a trigger in the Portland ordinance that when the production, down towards the bottom of the page, when the production of biodiesel from Oregon-grown feedstock reaches a level of 5 million gallons on an annualized basis, then there's going to be a notification to retailers and distributors that 50% of the biodiesel that is going to be met for the ordinance, biodiesel, the feedstock needs to be from those four families that I mentioned. The other 50% can be recycled cooking oil, it can be soybean, in no circumstance may it be palm oil.
Okay. All right, well, that answers my question. Does any of the committee have a question? Senator Ringley.
Thank you. Does this have an estimated fiscal?
No, we don't do those
but it's not a tax.
Potential bills.
Okay, but I'm wondering if there's been any discussion about that as to what the potential of the tax credit is.
This is the City of Portland.
I'm asking the committee, really.
Well, you're asking about LC 1805.
That's right.
Yeah, whether there's a fiscal on it and the potential of the tax credit. I don't know that.
It's a revenue stream, not an
issue. There is a fiscal impact. I mean, all the tax credits in there are going to have a impact on their income tax credits, so they will.
Thank you.
I mean, but the bill does allow local taxing jurisdictions to opt out, so you know there is that provision in there. And Senator Ringo finish, and then Senator Nelson.
My only comment is I think this is a terrific idea. Hi, Randy, by the way. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
My belief is that whenever we're putting in statute a tax credit, that we put a sunset on it because we can never reel it back in unless we get a three-fifths vote. Mm-hmm. And even for something that I like as much as I do for this one, I just think it makes sense. So that's a comment to Mr. Revenue over there also.
Okay, we're going to bring in Paul Warner and see if he can come in and address that concern that you have. Senator Nelson.
Thank you. I'm understanding the governor's office has a package out, and their renewable standards is similar, except they include the states of Washington and Idaho. Have you heard of that?
Well, again, you can't, as Senator Walker pointed out, you can't actually identify who you want it to come from. There are a number of reasons that that's not legal. You can, however, be artful in how you describe the criteria of the product that you want to buy, and understanding that it there isn't a lot of.
I was just saying the governor's proposal is going to be somewhat different than this, just because I think it specifically names the states of Washington, Idaho, and Oregon.
Right, and the governor's proposal doesn't have some of the things that we have either, because they didn't go out to Pendleton like our committee did. Maybe his staff did, but you know we went out to Pendleton, so I wanted to make sure that I think he has a higher level to start out with, and we sort of graduated it. But it's okay. I mean, we get them in the hopper, and we start talking about them. And this bill was supposed to, I just got it this morning, so I apologize. I haven't looked at it either as closely. I just know what it was supposed to have in it. But there was also supposed to be a tax credit in here for people to convert their vehicles to more fuel-efficient vehicles. Yeah. And that one came about because I watched a 60-minute program on May 7th of 06 talking about Brazil making ethanol from sugar cane and talking about the Midwest going to E85. And one of the things is they said that you can convert a standard car and that government should give tax credits to people to convert their old cars. So that's why I put it in here, because we can't wait for the federal government to do anything. And I also have my note here, and then I'll go to Senator George. Our visit to Kent Madison's farm was on July 28th, and it says right here at the top, 12 cents a pound is the profitable point for canola. Yeah, so in your negotiations...
There's a motion between September and
May I clarify that? 12 cents, but you have to figure out how much yield you get. 12 cents at 1,000 pounds is a lot different than 12 cents at 3,000 pounds. So it's the yield, it's not the price.
All right.
We are going to come to an agreement. Actually, yeah. Kent Madison has done a spreadsheet. I don't know if you know this, Senator Nelson, but he's actually come to our office with a spreadsheet, and we're actually going through the numbers so that everybody can walk away when we're done with the deal, not just saying, well, they said it had to be 12 or 14 or 21, but we actually go through the numbers and the production phases to get to an agreed price. Mm-hmm. We want it to be... We don't want such a good deal that you don't grow canola. That destroys the premise. We want a deal that you and your constituents can look at and go, this is a reasonable rate of return for us dedicating the land to this, and we're guaranteed that price. That's whatever that spot is.
All right. Just don't take it all from sequential now.
On that same subject, if I may, is, you know, one of my ideas that drives some people mad is that what we ought to do is mandate that a certain amount of ground is put into canola. In exchange for that, farmers would be allowed to take a certain amount of water out of the Columbia River and dedicate it. The thing you have to be concerned about with canola is that you say you maybe need 3,000 acres. Well, you can't grow it on that same 3,000 acres year after year after year because mm-hmm. it's three, so it's like they recommend a 4-year rotation. You'd probably get away with three if you wanted to. But you've got to have a substantial, much greater amount of acres. So I'm thinking, well, why don't we create an industry out in my part of the country? We have the land available. We just don't have the water. Take 500,000 acres and say you're going to have to dedicate 125,000 acres every year to the growing of canola, and in return for that, we will allow you to use water out of the Columbia River.
As I communicated to you in one of our exchanges, I think that we have to talk about that, and I think that has to be on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would hope we do is get you and your constituents involved. I would like to be involved with that, the environmental community, because this is a win for everybody if we can move past some of these hurdles that I'm very familiar with. I've served on committees with you, and you're one of the examples I use. I say Dave Nelson is one of the nicest people in the world, but you start talking about water and he turns red. And I learned that. But it would be great to get everybody in the room and talk about the tremendous benefit this could be to everybody by producing a crop that we would actually burn in our vehicles, get the revenue from as a state versus send it to Houston or some Middle East country. I mean, there's more benefit than what appears directly from this initiative.
Commissioner Leonard, they have wonderful people out there in that neck of the woods
they
of
do.
Our state.
I had a wonderful time.
Mr. Hale gave us an incredible presentation on farmers and the need for water out in that area. If you haven't ever spoken with him, you need to have a conversation with him.
Good reason for me to go back. I can't say enough how hospitable the mayor of Pendleton was and the farmers. We had a great dinner in downtown Pendleton. I can't remember the name of the restaurant.
Raphael's.
What was it?
Raphael's.
Raphael's. And then we had a great breakfast where I would look for any opportunity to go back and spend a couple days.
Actually, Bob Hale lives in Portland. He's back.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, he commutes back and forth.
Medium and Pendleton.
He lives. I mean, he has. You could probably get home. I could try and make the arrangements.
I would love that. Yeah.
He was quite upset because some of his property his water was cut off, and he said the people in the city of Portland would be pretty mad if their water was cut off, and it's because there's not enough water available. And he gives you a great presentation.
Yeah, so I'd love to do that.
Senator George, I think you were next. Were you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, you two. Good to have you here. Question on this contract. Since you're basically contracting production,
mm-hmm.
are you impacted by any requirement that you would go out of state? Because I can contract with whoever I want to. You can contract with whoever you want to. It appears to me that since you're contracting for production, you can just about say where you want it done. Is that correct?
That's what we're doing.
That's what
I don't know if we can or not, but that's what we're doing.
Well, we're talking about two separate issues. One is the City of Portland contract to supply its fleet and the City of Portland ordinance. So with the contract to supply the fleet, we can buy from, as you mentioned, whomever we'd like to.
Yeah. And when you step out that next level, actually go out and ask for the production, I think you're outside of any trade issues type thing.
I think so.
One question too, because we've actually looked at this idea about what we're going to do, and I just got through paying a massive fuel bill, mm-hmm. so believe me, I'm thinking about it, and that is how much additional cost per gallon or percentage of the fleet cost do you expect this switch over to bring?
Well,
I would imagine it's pretty minor.
It's beyond, and it depends what time of year you want to talk about. Last summer, when this ordinance came up for a hearing in late June, we did a survey of all the metropolitan area diesel outlets, and a gallon of pure biodiesel was a nickel a gallon less than petroleum diesel. Today, a gallon of petroleum diesel is about $2.99, $3 a gallon in the Portland metropolitan area. The place I go to get 100% diesel is $3.29. So, but again, even if there is a price difference, and we're talking about in the ordinance a 5% addition, the impact is less than a penny a gallon if there's that spread at that time. But as you know, I mean, at a moment's notice, we could be on the bad end of a cartel that decides, you know what, we're tired of supplying these guys with petroleum for, $60 a barrel. We're going to make it, $105 a barrel. Then you're talking, let me remind you, last summer we didn't find out what the point was that people will quit buying fuel. as the price was going up. Okay. We don't know what that price is. We do know that it's higher than $3.50 a gallon, because that's what they're appearing in Portland, and the traffic jams were exactly the same at $3.50 a gallon than they are today at $2.25 a gallon. So we don't know how high they can crank this price up, and what we're saying, and I think what you guys are saying and grappling with, is let's create an alternative source of fuel that doesn't have those political kinds of hostage aspects to them, that we end up being a victim of what a foreign interest decides they want to charge us. I mean, we have really no control over that. This is an industry that will be completely and totally dependent upon Oregon farmers or Northwest farmers and even American farmers. I mean, that's a totally different dynamic than what we're dealing with today. And if it ends up costing, I'll tell you how people in Portland feel, and I think a lot of people feel like this. Mm-hmm. If I have to pay 25 cents more a gallon knowing I'm buying a product that was grown by Dave Nelson or his constituents, I'll drive across town to do that versus buying a gallon of fuel that I know goes directly to Houston and Middle East countries. And people in Portland, and I think all over the state, I think, talk about patriotism. This is an initiative that really cuts to the chase in terms of standing up for our country.
I think the testimony we had in Pendleton, we had the state representative from Washington, who was a co-sponsor, chief sponsor on that bill. She had a brochure that they were distributing around the state at the different service stations, talking about the alternative fuels that were available. And I think that'd be a great thing here in Oregon, grown in Oregon, fuel grown in Oregon.
We're actually working with Kent Madison on a grown in Oregon. You may know of this, Senator Nelson. Label to put on pumps that sell the product from Eastern Oregon, so people in Oregon that buy fuel can actually look at a pump and see that it's an Oregon product.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we have some great graphic ideas to develop this logo that the Pendleton Grain Growers Association mm-hmm. would adopt and ship as part of their biofuel tool.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I've got two questions down here, and then we've got someone here from LRO to answer your text credit question, Senator Ringo. So I will take Senator Ringo and then Senator Bates for questions. Yours is done, Senator Bates.
More of a comment. First, I want to commend Oregon for doing this and Portland for doing it.
Thank you.
We talk a lot about the rural urban divide. Talk about bridging the divide. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate you.
I've said many times, Senator Bates, it's great to talk about bridging the urban-rural split, but the one thing that does it the most effectively is money. and we had a great laugh with the guys in Eastern Oregon when I was back there talking about this. That we appreciate having your mayor come over and all that, but you bringing a contract to do a deal is that's what we're talking about.
And I would support your personal one about I have a Passat. We run 100%. Buy on that too.
Oh, you do.
And it was cheap. It's cheaper down there today in Southern Oregon than.
Well, we're held hostage by everything.
Yeah, same problem. if you want to know where the break point is for per gallon cost, they've done some studies on this. It's right above $5 a gallon. That's when people start changing their driving habits at $5 a gallon. They don't do below that. Amazing. But at $5 a gallon, they really start changing driving habits.
Wow. I think it's pretty funny about your comment there, because Mr. Madison also said that, hey, I don't grow this stuff because I think it's great for the environment. I grow it because I can make money.
That's right. That's
and,
great
you know, that there's nothing wrong with that.
Exactly.
Nothing wrong with that at all. We all have to make a living somehow, and he's making his living doing this, and he's doing something environmental besides.
Move forward.
Very progressive farmer. I love the way he farms. I mean, he starts out his presentation showing Mom and Pa with a pitchfork. I think it's the grandparents who originally started on the farm. And then today, I mean, it's incredible. Everything's computerized.
For some reason, he felt compelled to drive me immediately to where all the city of Portland's waste had me stand outside. And I was like, okay, I get it now. How impressed can we go?
All right. Well, if there's no further questions, we'll have LRO come up. And thank you both
thank
for coming.
Great.
Appreciate
to see
it.
Everybody.
Good to see you all. So I think we have Chris Alamek from LRO to answer this question. Legislative Revenue Office, for those of you out in the Internet.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chris Alamek from the Legislative Revenue Office. And
great. And Senator Ringo had a question. I'll just have him repose it to you.
Well, I was just wondering if there's been any estimate as to the potential revenue impact upon this bill.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, there has not yet. I have not produced a revenue impact on the income tax credit. The bill also contains affects the property tax as well, and I don't believe we have produced any estimates on the revenue impact for this bill.
Okay. Obviously, that'll be part of the analysis.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
And could you just generally sort of tell us how tax credits impact our budget? I mean, we all know, but let's just put it out there on the table.
Madam Chair, tax credits are a dollar-per-dollar reduction of income tax liability. So taxpayers will—they'll have their taxable income, and they'll take—they'll report income, and then they'll take away deductions, and get to a taxable income, and then the taxable income is subject to the income tax rates, either 6.6% on the corporate side, or 5.79% on the personal side, and then that amount, from that amount, any tax credits that the taxpayer is allowed to take reduce that amount. Most credits are not refundable, meaning if the taxpayer's liability reduces down to zero, there may be unused credits. On the corporation side, many of these credits have carry forwards, meaning that any unused credit could be used in future years, up to 5 or 15 years, depends on the credit.
Individuals don't have that same opportunity for carryover?
There are some.
Some.
There are some.
Because I know I've taken advantage of.
Yes.
I don't remember what they are in my history, but.
Yeah, it's kind of a mix.
Yeah.
And on the personal side, there are a couple of refundable credits. The working family credit is currently refundable and has been since 2003. And in 2006, the earned income credit becomes refundable, meaning that when the taxpayer's liability gets reduced to zero, any unused credit is then refunded to the taxpayer.
Right. Okay, great. Well, I appreciate that explanation for us and the those in the room and out on the Internet.
Those of us who've been in revenue and have supported many tax breaks because we believe that it will, in the long run, yield much more money to the state. And we just heard about Genentech being brought into Washington County with substantial tax credits being offered. As an economist, and you guys look at these kind of things, obviously those communities, that county, that city, they're not being foolish in offering those tax breaks. Are there any studies that would give us an indication, particularly with a brand new industry coming in or pure brand new technology, expansion of economic growth in one area of the state that's been depressed? Do we have anything that gives us a way to measure the net impact? In other words, we gave this credit here, but I believe our yield many times is going to be way beyond anything that we gave away credit.
Madam Chair, Senator George, that is a topic of much discussion. And I, off the top of my head, I'm not aware of any studies that I could point you right now and say and hand it to you and say, here's the one. I'm sure there has been work done out there. One of the tricky things about that is kind of a baseline of what would have occurred had the credit not been there.
Right.
And so you need kind of two versions to do it exactly and really well. You need two versions of reality, in a sense, where you have the activity that would have occurred anyway and then with the credit. And that's what makes those kinds of studies challenging, but I can look into whether or not there have been estimates.
OTIM tries.
OTIM.
OTIM. What's OTIM?
The tax incidence model. So it's our Chris does performs it, but it's our attempt to judge, is this incentive going to work? Is it going to produce the jobs that we think it's going to produce, or is it anecdotal? There's always that if, but OTIM is our best, what we have here is our best example of, if we do a tax incentive, will it actually produce what we hope it would produce?
That's correct, Madam Chair, Senator Deckard. OTIM is, it's a general equilibrium model, or it's a dynamic analysis model where it's a model of Oregon's economy kind of in equilibrium right now, and then we institute a change into that system, and that affects relative prices. And then it incorporates the behavioral side of the response to those changes, and then you get a new equilibrium. And then you can see what has the impact to personal income or employment. And those are two of the key factors that people like to see.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you for coming down on short notice. I appreciate it.
Welcome.
And I think we're going to hear from Lindsay Capps next. We need to move along as we're running out of time today. I don't know about any of you, but I need some wool socks.
It's so cold
really
here.
Cold in here.
You're saving energy.
Peter, freezing. I don't know if we're trying to save money or what, but.
Chair Walker and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. For the record, my name is Lindsay Capps. I am the legislative director for the Oregon Environmental Council, and wanted to thank you, obviously, for your attention throughout the course of this year to this the biofuels issue and taking time, obviously, to meet with folks in, obviously, in Eastern Oregon and other stakeholders around the state to talk about this. We think it's a really exciting opportunity for Oregon. Obviously, there are great there's great potential for biofuels or biofuels industry in Oregon for rural economic development, for job creation. Certainly to move our nation closer to energy independence, which seems to be a more pressing goal as the days go on. And it's also good for our environment. Obviously, by running cleaner fuels in our engines, we reduce a lot of toxins in our air, and we reduce a lot of the emissions that are leading to global warming. So this, again, is somebody, I think Commissioner Leonard said, this is really a win-win solution for Oregon, and I applaud your efforts to move a bill forward in this next session. We've been engaged over the last 6 months or so in a stakeholder process under the Renewable Energy Working Group. There are other participants in that process that are in this room today and have come up through that process with a package, which a lot of that is included in your bill, Senator Walker, and the committee's bill that we'll be looking at today, that provides incentives for feedstock production, for the processing of biofuels in Oregon. We think all of those are very important. In addition to that, though, we also think that there's a need for growers and processors to have a stable market. And so part of that is, or part of the policy that needs to be put in place in addition to those incentives, or sort of in tandem with those incentives, is a flexible renewable fuel standard, which would just require a minimum blend of ethanol or biodiesel in petroleum gasoline or diesel sold in the state. Under the governor's proposal, that is currently set to be triggered at a 2% biodiesel blend based on local production from Oregon, from Washington, from Idaho, and Montana. So that wouldn't go into effect by a date certain, as it would in Portland's case, but when local production meets that level. And we think that's an important principle in terms of incentivizing local production of these fuels. It would then move on to a B5 blend at 15 million gallons. Again, on the same standard that biofuels is being produced from local feedstocks, or I should say biodiesel in particular, and then has a simple standard for ethanol, which is a 10% ethanol blend once we reach 90 million gallons. So we think taken together, this is a really exciting proposal in terms of moving the industry forward and again doing it in a way where we're giving growers an opportunity to grow for a market and take part in this burgeoning industry. So with that, I'll open it up to any questions you might have.
Great. Senator Nelson and Senator George.
Thank you, Lindsay. I just was going to ask you, do you know how many gallons of biodiesel is produced from, say, like a 2,000-pound per acre crop? Do you have those figures available?
Chair Walker, Senator Nelson, I don't have those figures available. I have heard numbers that around somewhere between 90 gallons to 110 gallons can be produced from an acre of canola. I think that's based on estimates from Kent Madison in his experience with his farm. So, but I don't have other numbers. I'd be happy to look those up for you and provide those to the committee.
Yeah. I was thinking it was someplace in there, maybe 130, but I think it depends on how many pounds per acre.
Yeah.
2,000 pounds per acre. But yeah. Madam Chair, if I could just mm-hmm. follow up with it. So I think this bill is very good. I don't think we're thinking in big enough terms and scope, though. And I want to reiterate my point is why doesn't the state of Oregon create some sort of policy where we would generate 40 million gallons of biodiesel. And we have the capacity to do that if we use the water. But we, I mean, we're in the situation where, I mean, we're thinking this kind of this little incremental thing with 5%, but why don't we just create this huge industry, mandate that farmers grow a certain amount and provide the water that they can do it. Don't put any incentives for them out there, because if you had this rotation thing, if they took a quarter of it, just let that go in the market and put that in canola, they will make money on those other three quarters. I can guarantee you that that's, you know, because with irrigated ground, they'll generate $5,000 to $6,000 an acre. And so if on a quarter of it, they only get $400 or $500 an acre just on the open market, they're still going to make money. And if we're talking about, you know, creating this whole new paradigm, trying to get away from the dependence of oil, foreign oil, I mean, we have the potential here in Oregon to do that. I think we ought to be looking on a much, much bigger scale.
I did hear that word mandate come out of you.
Yeah, I know it. I'm right. But in return for a mandate, I want something else.
I appreciate that.
I was with you, but to the mandate.
Senator George.
For the position of your organization, what about doing what Portland is doing, which I think is so right on the money and so progressive, and that is contract growing. If we decide we want 5%, we're going to go out there and say, all right, we're going to offer you a reasonable price for this. We want you to contract grow. Because then you have a positive relationship. You're not dangling an incentive and hoping growers respond, but saying, I will pay you a certain amount to produce that product. What is your opinion relative to the state of Oregon doing that?
Well, there, I haven't considered that. It's an interesting concept. There is in the governor's bill, and I think it's in this bill, I haven't had a chance to fully read through this. Alternative fuels mandate, which we think is a really important policy in terms of, again, providing the market for growers to grow for. Mm-hmm. We'd be in full support of that being organized in such a way or contracted in a way that comes from Oregon-grown canola. Or other Oregon-grown production. I haven't had a chance to consider other alternatives in terms of larger scale contracting. interesting idea.
Well, Dave's idea, you know, a long time ago, many of us have speculated, well, if we could only get those H's out of that H2O, you know, we could just turn water into energy. But he's turning water into energy, too, with his plan. So I think it's a pretty good idea. We'll give you that water.
Okay, even with a mandate?
No mandates. I want incentives.
Any questions from this side? All right. Thank you very much. Thank you,
thank
Mr.
you very
Taft.
Much for your time.
I appreciate your testimony. All right, colleagues, we have an LC draft in front of us. That's all the testimony we're going to take today. So can I get a motion?
Sure. Madam Chair, I move LC draft 1805. Is that the
yes,
right one?
Yes, that's correct.
Be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Nelson has moved LC draft 1805 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? No, I think we've discussed ourselves out. All right. So those of the opinion LC draft 1805 should be introduced as a committee bill will say aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Becker.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Nelson.
Aye.
Senator Ringo.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Byers.
Excuse.
Chair Walker.
Aye. Okay, motion carries, and LC draft 1805 will be introduced as a committee bill. I don't think I've been saying that all along, but oh well, we all know what's been going on.
You know what you mean.
You know what I mean. My husband never knows what I mean, but you know what I mean. Okay, we're going to move along to model appliance and equipment energy efficiency standards bill. We have one person to testify on that, Jeremy Bauman. Do you want to come up? How much do we have left? We have this, two memorials, and then one additional issue. So we should be done. Yes. Okay. Thanks. Hi.
Good morning.
Jeremiah, not Jeremy. Okay, identify yourself, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremiah Bauman. I'm an environmental advocate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. And I'm here to speak on behalf of the Energy Efficient Appliance Standards Bill. Would you like me to go ahead and give a summary?
Yeah. Colleagues, let me just tell you that what we have is a model bill here in front of you. It's been assigned an LC number 1895. Just hasn't been drafted, but this is the language that will be folded into the draft. So go ahead and give us your testimony.
Good. Well, we've heard a lot to date, members of the committee, about energy independence on the biofuels topic, and a lot of the same concerns and benefits apply for the issue of energy efficiency and energy conservation. Oregonians are increasingly dealing with a range of problems related to the energy, specifically rising costs, not only for gasoline, but for natural gas, for electricity, for home heating in particular during the winter months. In addition, dependence on out-of-state and foreign fuels, that includes not only our oil supply coming from the Middle East, but natural gas comes from other countries primarily, and even the coal that we use for electricity comes entirely from out-of-state. And on top of that, of course, there are the environmental impacts of our current energy generation, whether it's air pollution in the Columbia Gorge or in other communities around the state, or increasingly the effects that we're seeing already from global warming and increasing global warming pollution. Without doubt, energy efficiency and energy conservation are the fastest, cheapest, and most direct ways to solve all of those problems. And much like renewable energy and biofuels, energy efficiency and conservation are win-wins. They save consumers and businesses money on their energy costs, and they provide environmental protection, price stability, and energy independence. The model bill today is based on the very same standard as the very same principle as the standard of the bill that passed last session, which included 11 appliances and passed with only a few dissenting votes in each chamber. That regulated 11 appliances and gave minimum energy efficiency standards for those appliances. The way that this works is that the federal government can set appliance efficiency standards. Where they don't set appliance efficiency standards, states are free to set their own, so that manufacturers aren't dealing with 50 different efficiency standards. The bills we typically recommend include very detailed technical specifications, so you'll see in the model language incredibly detailed numbers that I couldn't even explain to you about technical specifications. Those are in the bill to make sure that we're not requiring manufacturers to meet different standards here than they would have to in other states that have acted similarly. The bill covers 7 products. The product described in the bill as a bottle-type water dispenser is manufacturer speak for a water cooler that you'd see in an office building or maybe in your home. Also commercial hot food holding cabinets like those used at restaurants, buffets, compact audio products, which is typically CD players, cassette players, DVD players. The product described as a portable electric spa, you might know more familiarly as a hot tub. it also includes walk-in refrigerators and freezers. As you can tell, there's all sorts of opportunities for interesting press events related to this bill. The big appliance in the bill, though, that I want to flag for a couple of reasons is residential furnaces. Those, by far, are the biggest energy savings available to Oregon right now, simply because the current furnaces are available at much higher efficiency rates that could save people a lot of money on bills and reduce fuel consumption significantly in Oregon households. It's worth flagging not only because that's a majority of the benefit that we get from this bill, but also because that is actually the one exception where two things are true. One is the federal government does have a standard for furnaces, so the states are preempted. However, the federal government, just within the last several months, the Federal Department of Energy released a decision that while they are raising the standard only slightly for furnaces in a way that will have very little impact, a large part of their decision to not raise it further to the level specified in this bill is because a lot of the warmer states don't need stronger furnaces, and therefore it's not cost-effective in large parts of the country. But in a state like Oregon, where we do have cold winters, it is cost-effective. And the Federal Department of Energy actually invited states that have colder weather to apply for a waiver and get permission to set their own standards. 3 states in the New England, Massachusetts, Vermont, and Rhode Island have all already set higher standards and are now beginning the process of applying for those waivers. So we're recommending that Oregon do the same thing. The rest of this products have all also been similar standards have been adopted in multiple states, California being the noteworthy one since they're right to our south. We get an additional benefit from making sure we set the same standards, which is that manufacturers don't send all of the inefficient products to Oregon when they're shipping products westward, since they have to ship the more efficient ones to California. Let me just wrap up by noting the benefits of this bill are quite substantial. In each year that the standards are in effect, the total savings in electricity are enough to power 2,000 Oregon households from the products sold that year. The savings in natural gas are enough to power 3,000 Oregon households. By the year 2030, we are saving enough energy every year to power 27,000 Oregon households, enough electricity and enough natural gas to power nearly 60,000 Oregon households. The cumulative financial savings, the net savings after accounting for slight increases in the cost of some of these products, by 2030 is over $260 million in savings for Oregon consumers and businesses, which is all money kept in the local economy rather than sent to out-of-state or foreign energy suppliers. So it's, again, a win-win in terms of economic benefits and environmental benefits for Oregon. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you. Questions from the committee? No, you did a great job. So tell me, does Washington State have a similar standard? So if we're talking about the Northwest corridor here, we're all going to be on the same page pretty much?
Washington State, we're basically acting in parallel with Washington.
Okay.
So during their last legislative session, they enacted standards for the same products that Oregon also enacted standards for. I think there was one exception where we enacted a standard that Washington didn't, but okay. California had enacted that standard. So the majority, I believe most, if not all of these bills, products are not yet regulated by Washington, but they are also planning to consider a very similar bill in their session that starts after the new year.
Okay, great.
And I can get back to you with specifics on whether any of them are already covered in Washington, but I don't believe they are.
Okay, terrific. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
I've lost my pseudo vice chair for the day. Do we have a quorum?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So I need someone to be Senator Nelson. Can I get someone to move? Conceptually move, or how do we do this? Because we don't have the draft, and this is the draft, but not the official draft.
Correct.
So, what's the language for that?
Madam Chair, members, and just to clarify, Judy Hall did confirm that this is given this point in the interim where there has been a crunch in trying to get drafts out of Legislative Council, as long as the committee was comfortable with the concept. We could introduce it with the LC number assigned by council when the drafting request went in. She is standing by in case you had any further questions about that and is watching us. This would be a straightforward motion to introduce LC 1895 as a committee bill.
Okay. So can I get someone to volunteer to do that?
So moved.
Yeah, good. Senator George moves LC draft 1895 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Hearing none. Those of the opinion LC draft 1895 be introduced as a committee bill will say aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Excused.
Senator Decker.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Nelson.
Excused.
Senator Ringo.
Aye.
Senator Steele.
Senator, you have to say excused.
Oh, excuse, I'm sorry.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Byers.
Excused.
Chair Walker.
Aye. Okay, LC 1895 having been adopted, will the motion carries. It'll be a committee bill, and I was getting a comment from Judith here that Jeff Bissonnette, you want to talk about this bill?
For the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. Just wanted to put on record to allay any concerns that are out there. There's going to be a separate bill that will be starting over in the House to make some technical fixes to last year's bill. There was some implementation dates that were aligned when it was passed, and both California and Washington have legislative sessions more frequently than we do here in Oregon. And so there's going to be a bill changing some of the implementation dates from the appliances that were in last year's or last session's bill. And I just wanted to put on record that that will be a separate piece of legislation that we'll be hoping to rocket through. And there was a concern that nobody thinks that this is going to be particularly controversial, but we just want to make sure that the two issues are going to be going to be on the track separately, and
okay.
and that other bill will be coming from the House, and will be going very fast. This one will be starting here, and assuming there's as little controversy as there was on last session's bill, should go through pretty quickly.
Okay.
But again, we're dealing with two different things.
So both bills will be needed.
Yes.
Okay. Senator George,
we have an answer to the question. Is there anyone who's tracking what's happening internationally? I just talked to a person that came back from China, and they were in a facility that is looking at all kinds of alternative energy. They also produce extremely high efficiency appliances.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they fit in with that. And do we have, is there any entity that is actually tracking to see how these different producers are doing relative to efficiency?
Yeah, there's a lot of tracking. Senator Walker, Senator George, there are a lot of people that are tracking sort of the increasing efficiencies of a variety of different appliances, both here in this country and around the world, and trying to keep both federal and state appliance standards kind of current with that, so that we can take advantage of the improving technologies. And when large states like particularly California, that is a neighbor to us and that is one of the larger economies on the globe, adopts that, we want to make sure that we're pretty close in line with something like that, because we want to make sure that we take advantage of those improvements that are being made on an ongoing basis, and so that we see more efficient appliances here. We could move forward on our own, but Oregon is such a small economy that it's not enough to move the market, but we can certainly take advantage of the ongoing monitoring and ongoing updating of those standards, and essentially that's what the bill last session did, and that's what this this bill that you just voted on is intended to do.
Madam Chair,
mm-hmm.
I know all of you are doing this, but I'm going to encourage you, if you're not, to do it, and that is any appliance you're going to buy, and particularly heating and cooling units, to go with this new technology, because it's amazed me how much savings we have found. I mean, it is a small investment on the top side of this, but we were able to take advantage of one tax incentive to put in the main system. But all of the other appliances that we have put in there, whether it's the new style washing machines, you keep thinking that can't be clean with that much water, and yet they do an amazing job. So, I mean, technology really is our friend right now to being able to deal with an energy shortage. So
mm-hmm.
encourage all of you to, boy, when you go to look at these products, I know you're going to do that. Make sure you buy those ones.
I did buy those expensive front loader washers and the front loader dryer, and we're saving quite a bit of money and using hardly any water, and the clothes are coming out just fine.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, colleagues, we're going to move right along. Mike Graney, you want to come up? We've got two memorials in your packet if you want to pull those out, one on Hanford and one on long-term energy tax credit. Okay, those will be the Hanford Memorial. Colleagues, will be LC1839 and the alternative energy production tax credit will be LC1907. Okay. Mr. Green, introduce yourself and tell us what we need to know.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike Graney, Director of the Oregon Department of Energy, and we're in support of both of these resolutions. The first one, dealing with Hanford, was submitted at the request of our Hanford cleanup board. It's a citizen oversight and advisory board, and it also includes six non-voting legislative members that we meet periodically on Hanford issues. Committee members are all familiar with Hanford. Just very briefly, it's over 1,000 radioactive contaminated sites in Washington State within 30 miles of the Oregon border. It's on the Columbia River and poses numerous threats to Oregon interests, everything from fisheries to agriculture in the event of a catastrophic accident, or even from gradual long-term leaks. And this resolution encourages Congress to provide continued necessary funding for the cleanup effort to continue. There have been some major challenges in the last couple of years with a key component, it's called the vitrification plant, which would solidify the liquid radioactive high-level waste. That's one of the biggest risks, and that really needs to move forward. And Congress has been looking very carefully at whether they continue full funding or not, so this will be very timely for this next Congress. It also calls for giving Oregon a full role in the decisions that are made at Hanford. There's a compliance agreement pursuant to the Superfund law that involves, it's called a tri-party agreement, but two of the three parties are federal agencies, Department of Energy itself and Environmental Protection Agency, and the third one's the state of Washington. And those parties really make the decisions on the scope and extent of cleanup and the pace of it, and we think Oregon should have a role in those discussions as well. So be happy to answer any questions, but I appreciate very much your willingness to sponsor this for us and for our board.
Great, thank you. Any questions? I don't think you're going to get any objection from us. Do we have a form? Okay, great. Well, thank you, Mr. Graney. We're going to act on this one right now. If I can get my colleague here.
This is a resolution?
Yeah, it's LC 1839.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move LC draft 1839 be introduced as a committee bill or resolution.
Committee bill.
Committee bill.
Yeah. As far as I know, isn't that right? Or memorial. Okay, great. Senator Nelson moves LC draft 1839 be introduced as a committee memorial. Any discussion? Hearing none, those of the opinion LC 1839 be introduced will say aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Oh, excuse.
Senator
Decker.
Aye.
Senator
George.
Aye.
Senator Nelson.
Aye.
Senator Ringo.
Excuse.
Senator Shields.
Excuse.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Beyer.
Excuse.
Chair Walker.
Here. Aye. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Graney. You'll take us to the next one.
Yes, Madam Chair. The LC 1907 urges Congress to provide a long-term extension to the Alternative Energy Production Tax Credit. This is a tax credit for renewable energy. It's been especially important for wind farms. It's currently at a rate of 1.9 cents per kilowatt hour, and what that does is a crucial piece to help make wind energy cost competitive with fossil fuel alternatives. It's been a critical piece for the wind industry and wind projects in Oregon and elsewhere in the country. The federal production tax credit has been in effect probably for close to 10 years, but it's only been in two or three-year increments each time. And the industry really needs long-term certainty that for financing, for being able to get wind component production facilities, and not just wind, but other renewable resources as well, to be able to get the equipment they need, the components. Wind turbines have been at a shortage recently because of the uncertainty there on the financing. Even as we've approved some major new wind power projects in Oregon. So this is very important. I might also add that when Congress extended this for 2 years as part of the Energy Policy Act 2 years ago, it provided a comparable tax credit for nuclear energy that goes for 15 years, I believe. So a 10-year extension is certainly not unusual for Congress to consider. I think it's very reasonable. The other thing I would mention is there's a companion incentive. It's called the Clean Energy Renewable Energy Bonds that publicly owned utilities are able to use. And I would suggest in the course of this being drafted that we include that provision as well, wherever the word tax credit is mentioned, also include the renewable energy bonds. It's a financing mechanism by Congress that provides the comparable incentive, but in a way that publicly owned utilities that don't have tax liability can use it.
Okay, great. Mr. Greening, I think Tom O'Connor wanted to come up and talk about that parallel one that you're talking about. If you would just stay here, because I'll have questions for you, too. Mr. O'Connor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom O'Connor with Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. We support LC 1907, and as Michael mentioned, would like to request that either conceptually, if you could include the renewal of the clean renewable energy bond program as well as the PTC. The situation is that unlike Oregon, which has a pass-through provision in the business energy tax credit, there's no provision like that in the federal production tax credit. And so nonprofit utilities, co-ops, rural co-ops, PUDs, and municipal utilities cannot use the PTC. We can, if we're buying from a facility, a private facility that has used the tax credit, the private entity can, of course, take the tax credit. But we cannot, there's no pass-through provision on that. We were successful in Congress this last time around, as Mike mentioned, in getting a provision, this clean renewable energy bond provision. It was a bipartisan bill. It was introduced. It's $800 million a year currently for 2 years. It expires the same way that the PTC does this year. It's a tax credit bond mechanism that allows nonprofit entities, rural co-ops, and municipal utilities to issue these bonds for renewable energy projects. And it's not really designed for big facilities like the PTC, but it works very well for small projects. It's nowhere near as rich a tax credit as the PTC, but it is something that gives us some ability to, when we're doing renewable projects, to also have an incentive program. So I would like to request that you include in this request for extension the Clean Renewable Energy Bond Program as well as the PTC.
Okay. So that's the name of the program, Clean Renewable Energy Bond Program?
Yes.
Okay. And that's all that would need to be added into this somewhere? Mm-hmm. We would just say, whereas we also support probably... If I'm looking at this memorial, before you get to the now, therefore, you have whereas a long-term extension of the tax credit would provide stability and certainty to the renewable energy industry, and then say also and renewable and an extension of the renewable clean energy bond program. Would you add it there?
Sure, or maybe to make it easier at this point, Madam Chair, we'd be happy to work with Mike and staff and get the
language.
The language right.
Okay. Yeah. So let me ask: is the committee comfortable with that? You think they can work out the language that would make you happy, Senator Deckert?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm fine. Just introducing bills. The only question I have, and this, maybe to the panel, is: do we have any evidence that joint memorials to Congress actually do anything? They take up a lot of time, and friends of mine in congressional offices, even our guys, the Oregon, say they just take them and they put them in a file, and or even the representative doesn't see from our own state. See our memorials, and so that's my only pause. Is
that would have been mine too, Senator Decker? But we have a different Congress now. I'm telling you, we have a different Congress now, and I just think maybe that will make a difference. I think it's important to us to make sure that the states know, or the federal government knows what the states need, and what they're thinking, and this particular alternative energy production tax credit, I've spoken before about, I served on the Clean and Diversified Energy Advisory Committee through the Western Governors Association for 18 months, and we put this packet together of things that we need, and that was the overarching concern over and over and over with all of the subgroups on all of the alternative energy projects is that we need certainty. If they can give nuclear a 15-year extension, they sure as heck can give us more than 2 years for alternative energy. So, it's an expression.
Mm-hmm. I'll go along. I just don't. I like the WGA and what they, from what I hear, understand.
Yeah.
They are very effective because they're lobbying.
Mm-hmm.
That's my only, is we do and a lot of joint memorials. And
that is theirs. I mean, we can make sure that the WGA gets a copy of our memorial, uh-huh. so they can take that in with their lobbying. I'll make sure that happens.
And Madam Chair, yeah. Senator Deckard, I'd add, too, there's other audiences besides Congress, like the Hanford Memorial. When you've passed a similar one in the past, we've used that in dealing with the U.S. Department of Energy directly as well as an indication of how strongly Oregonians are concerned about Hanford. So
that's helpful.
These are helpful.
That is.
Okay, great. So we don't seem to have a problem with conceptually amending, and if you can talk to Judith about the language, that would be fine. And Mr. Greeney, I want to talk with you about this because there's a lot of things in the Clean and Diversified Energy Advisory Committee report that I don't know if the department is going forward on in terms of the things the states can do. So it's too late for this committee to introduce bills, but if you and I can talk about it, I can have them drafted.
Be glad to. And some of those are being picked up in the governor's energy legislative package.
I thought they might be, and I wasn't sure, so that's why I want to talk to you. And whichever ones the governor's not picking up, then I want to make sure we get in the hopper because this is a really great blueprint for the future.
Be glad to do that.
Okay, thank you. We will hear from Senator Nelson next.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move LC draft number 1907 be introduced as a memorial.
Oh, first of all, we have to take a motion to amend LC 1907 to add this program.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move that we amend LC draft 1907 for renewal of clean renewable energy
bond
program.
You can't read my writing very well.
Doing fast.
Okay. Senator Nelson moves that we amend LC draft 1907 to add information about the renewal of the clean renewable energy bond program. Any discussion? Okay, without objection, that will be done. So, Senator Nelson, the next motion.
Madam Chair, I move LC draft 1907 as amended be introduced as a memorial. Is that how we're talking?
As amended.
As amended.
Okay, great. Senator Nelson moves LC 1907 as amended to be introduced as a committee memorial. It is now up to you to vote. So if you support it, say aye. Those opposed, say no. The clerk will call the roll. I lost my head for a moment.
Senator Deckard.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse.
Senator
Shield. Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Fire.
Excuse.
Chair Walker.
Aye. Did I excuse Senator Bates? You didn't call in. Oh, I
yes,
did?
You did?
Okay. Great. Thank you. Okay. Thanks, colleagues. The motion carries. LC draft 1907, as amended, will be introduced. We're going to move right along. Did you have a question, Senator George?
Madam Chair, before I put this back in the file, would the committee be agreeable to the idea of pursuing a bill for the watershed-based toxic monitoring, the package 121, to allow for the establishment of accounts within the Department of Environmental Quality to receive grants, donations, and that sort of thing?
The
question that I asked.
That is the question you asked. I don't mind.
Judith, would you have time to look into that?
Madam Chair, Senator George, yes, and if that's the committee's desire, I can put in a drafting request, and the Judiciary Committee will be meeting later this in December, and could, in fact, if you wished, if this was the desire of the committee, they could introduce that bill on behalf of the committee at their meeting.
Madam Chair, it may not be a big deal, but you know when we had the Remember My Tax Me More bill, mm-hmm. Actually the Treasury Department set up accounts, and they are actually receiving money of people making contributions. I think this one may have the potential for fairly large contributions. A lot of people have wanted to do something about this. I'll leave it up to you guys. I'll probably pursue it if we don't.
Well, I'm fine if the committee is. The committee have any objection to that? Okay. Then the motion is that do we need a motion here?
No.
No, it's just what we've talked about, and I'll ask Judith to have it drafted, and the Judiciary Committee on which I sit will then introduce it as a committee bill from us. Okay. Great. Thank you. All right. Next thing we have is another one of our... Is this the last thing?
Yes.
Oh, cool. This is the last thing. Great. So I'm going to have Phil Ward come up from the Water Resources Department. Colleagues, we heard in Pendleton about water storage issues and some of the other water issues from the department. And this would be another discussion about writing a letter in support of what they wanted to do. So I just thought I'd have Mr. Ward come up and talk to you.
Thank you. And with your permission, Madam Chair, I'd like Debbie Colbert from my staff to join me.
Sure.
To wherever she went. There she is. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about the whole issue of water supply and anticipating dealing with Oregon's need for water supply in the future to meet its economic and environmental needs in the years ahead. It's interesting because I had an intern we have at the office a few months ago do a survey of the 18 western states that are members of an organization called the Western States Water Council to determine how many of those states had a comprehensive strategy in place for addressing their future water supply needs. And of the 18 western states that she surveyed, there were two that did not have a comprehensive water supply strategy in place. One was Alaska.
Did you say?
And the other was us.
Oh.
And, Madam Chair, I have felt for some years that we needed to take a hard look at how Oregon was going to meet its water supply needs. We've, in fact, proposed projects along this line for federal funding both of the last 2 years, which the governor has supported those funding requests. Obviously, we know the constraints on the federal budget, and we haven't been successful. So what we have done is submit for the governor's consideration a project we're calling the Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative. And you see that outlined on the little one-pager before you. And so, with your permission, I'd like to have Debbie Colbert just run quickly through what the elements of that proposal are with you, and then we'd be happy to entertain any questions, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. Thank you. Ms. Colbert?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Debbie Colbert. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator with the department. And the Water Supply Initiative has five key elements, as we've outlined on this one-pager. The first is to get an understanding of what do we need for the future, both to meet in-stream needs and out-of-stream needs in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. The second element gets at what are our opportunities for meeting those future supply needs, opportunities such as above and below ground storage of water, opportunities that we may achieve through conservation of existing supplies, including water reuse. And then the last element of the initiative is to provide incentive funding to communities and regions of the state that are taking a hard look at how they're going to meet their long-term water supply needs and provide some type of cost share or incentive funding program for those communities to do their work.
So, Madam Chair, this is actually a budget proposal that we've submitted for the consideration of the governor, and obviously we'll know next week whether that's been made a part of the governor's budget. But, again, this is something we feel is extremely important for the state of Oregon to move forward on so that it's obvious that we're going to have additional water supply needs in the state. We're already in Senator Nelson's district, there are already very significant water supply shortages related to depleted groundwater, which you all saw when you were there. So we think there's tremendous opportunity here. Again, we talked a little bit about when the last time I was with you, the city of Pendleton's recharge project, where they're actually using 60% of their municipal supply is now water taken from the Umatilla River in the winter, run through their city municipal treatment plant and put back down the municipal supply wells. So they're only using 40% native groundwater now and 60% of water that's been through this process. We think we need to identify where those opportunities are around the state and put a process in place for developing those opportunities.
Mr. Ward, thank you both. What is the total dollar amount you're asking for in this package?
The package as submitted for the governor's consideration was just a little short of $900,000.
Oh, that doesn't seem like a lot of money, but are you keeping a tab, Senator Nelson?
Yes, I am.
$900,000. Okay. Let me ask, did you see Water Watch has provided some written testimony in response to your package? Did you have an opportunity to look at that?
Madam Chair, we have not had an opportunity to review that yet. We understand your staff informed us that they have had submitted written comments. We hadn't received it or hadn't seen it, at least, by the time we left the office this morning. But we'd be happy to review that and provide a response to both you and Water Watch itself if you would desire.
Yeah, I would appreciate that. And, you know, we're all working under very strict timelines, and I didn't get this until last night either on my way out the door to drive up here. But they do have some concerns that, you know, some of this is going to get around some of the existing law. So I do want you to take a look at that. And
be happy to do that.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have submitted a bill, basically, on the lines of this thing, and you know, I'm open to any suggestions or changes or anything like that.
Oh, okay. So you've submitted a bill.
I've submitted a bill similar to that.
So if it doesn't make the governor's budget, we've got a bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and I'm going to have a couple other additional bills too. They're still in the works.
Okay.
So,
did you know that Senator Nelson had a bill about like this?
I was not aware of it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did. Because one of the things I was thinking that we might be able to do as a committee, again, would be to submit a letter in support of the policy option package, but we don't even know yet if it's in the governor's budget. So maybe we should just hold off on doing that and let your bill flow if theirs doesn't make the cut. Okay. All right. I just wanted to get that on the table because I thought that conversation we had in Pendleton was very important and pointed out some critical areas of need in this state for water storage. What are you, Senator George?
Madam Chair, just the other day I had a chance to talking to a group of folks affected by DHS budget, and I told them, I said, you know, you can wait until we get the budget, but then the agency is going to be required to defend the governor's budget. What you want to do is intervene early and try to influence the governor's budget.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you guys think about having the letter go right away?
Mike?
You know, mm-hmm. I mean, the governor's office is very aware of this, as I understand it. He is on record, at least in two public occasions, where he said he was including it in his budget. But I thought we should have a bill anyway for the legislature to talk
mm-hmm.
about. So
the governor's budget's coming out, I thought it comes out Friday, so
yeah.
I'm not sure we can get a letter that's going to make any impact or any difference at this point, because that's Friday's tomorrow.
Right. You're probably monitoring the hearing, though.
Yeah.
So now you know what we want.
Participate. Okay, great. Well, then we won't move on this since we've got some motion here from Senator Nelson during the session. I appreciate that you came in and briefed us on this again, and we'll look forward to seeing it in the governor's budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right,
thank you.
Okay, we had two other small things that got added to the agenda very briefly. Bill Cluding wanted to give us a little update on small rural schools. You want to come on up, and then Senator Shields has a little issue for us, and then I think we'll be done.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Walter, Senators, for the record, my name is Bill J. Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. Last week there was some good news in the newspapers. Oregon budget expected to have a little surplus, but Last session, I went around to both chambers and talked to various people and told them that Oregon could possibly expect a $273 million shortfall. The shortfall I'm talking about is the Rural County School Secure Fund. I projected then that Oregon was going to lose that. So far, hopefully I'm wrong, but so far, it looks like the best we're going to come out with is maybe a Band-Aid of $100 million-plus for 1 year, and this fund will cease. A few examples, Douglas County's $40 million. Lane County is $50 million. Almost every county in this state, their budgets are going to be gutted. I hate to put a damper on this enthusiasm, but I hope I'm wrong. But again, I think we have to take a long look of what we're going to do in a few years. Again, I see one more year. The timber industry is still in crisis. In the last few months, we lost another mill at Lebanon. Announcement this week of a mill in Independence. We are working on some ways to create jobs in our forest, and thank you, Senator Nelson, for your 1072 bill. We will be presenting the final draft to you folks probably the second week in January. That could possibly create a few jobs, especially in the rural areas. But again, thank you for your time, and I just wanted to state this for the record. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Cluding, I appreciate that because that money is really critical to our counties. And I'm not sure how we're going to make up that money if we don't get it. Do we have a memorial? I mean, we're throwing out memorials. Do we have a memorial to Congress on that one? We could write one.
Senator, if I may, there was one put out
last session.
Previous session.
Yeah.
And I urge this body to recommend another one fast track because I think we're going to need it. Thank you.
Did Mr. Cluding, do you know if we passed that memorial last session?
It was signed, passed, and signed by all members in both chambers, and
okay.
Presented to our congressional leaders.
Okay, so they know what we're thinking. So I don't want to spend money to do it again, but thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I did. Okay, and Senator Shields, you had something.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to the committee about something that they might not be aware of. As I travel around the country, I come across interesting stuff, and bluntly, and you're each getting a magazine. These were sent to my father-in-law, who lives in Arkansas. It's the Arkansas Wildlife Magazine. Okay? I'd just like you to take a look at them. They're beautiful magazines. If you look inside, on the first page, it says that it's published by the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. Do you see that up in the corner?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. State magazine put out by a state department, not unlike our own Department of Fish and Wildlife. If you have time and you read letters to the editor, pretty much paid for by subscriptions. People subscribe to the magazine. I remember reading one lady said it was worth the $12 for the magazine just to get the beautiful calendar that they get. It's a nature calendar. You know, it's beautiful. Okay? Where am I going with this? Picked up another one from the state of Missouri. See this one?
Mm-hmm.
Go to the inside. It's got the same thing. It's published by the Missouri Department of Conservation. Every state has a different name, but it's Fish and Wildlife and so on. Most of you have probably seen this. Maybe you've never read it. See this one? This one says Oregon Fish and Wildlife Journal.
Mm-hmm.
Is it published by the state? One would think so. It looks like it's published by the state. But in fact, it's not. It's published by, I've been trying to figure that out. I've looked over and over. Oregon Fish and Wildlife Journal, Summers 2006, Volume 28, Number 3. Talked to Senator Deckard a while ago. Talked to both Senators Bates and Ringo, they thought maybe it was put out by the Department of Fish and Wildlife. It's not. It's a knockoff. It's made to look like something published by the state. In fact, it endorsed a candidate for governor in here. It doesn't matter whether it's right-wing or left-wing knockoff, in my opinion. It shouldn't be happening. You follow what I'm saying? It's embarrassing to have a situation where something looks very much like a publication of the state, and yet at the same time is put together by interest groups, lobbyists, essentially, and you don't even notice unless you step back and take a very, very, very careful look at it. I became a little bit surprised, and I don't want to go into this, but when they essentially endorsed one candidate for governor over another. If it had been done by a Department of Fish and Wildlife, I know that would never happen. You know? So I'm just asking you to kind of talk with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm not going to be here. But ask them to maybe take a look at what some other states, and these are not rich states, you know? They're not necessarily as progressive as Oregon is. But they've got departments that communicate with the public has a chance to communicate back with them, they do some things that get the issue out there. If Arkansas and Missouri can do it, I bet Oregon can. You know what I'm saying? So, and especially since there's a knockoff that kind of looks like it's being put out by the State Department, we ought to take a good hard look at what's happening. I don't want to go into some of the articles. I think some of you would be very happy to see some of the articles, and some of you would be offended by them. There was one in here, and I'll say this, maybe I shouldn't, but there was one in here that really lambastes former President Al Gore for his global warming theories, you know, and it wants to debunk that. Well, some of you might agree that Al Gore needs to be debunked and others wouldn't. The point is, if it was the State Department of Fish and Wildlife that was really putting it out, that article wouldn't be in there. So I'm urging the department to think about this. Judith did a fine job of connecting us with the new department head, Virgil Moore, who I haven't even had a chance to meet. I've worked a lot with Fish and Wildlife, but I think he tuned in on the TV just to watch us. I didn't want to ask anybody from the department to come and defend themselves or anything like that. But I just hope you'll kind of consider this and look at the future, and I hope you enjoy the magazines that I've given you. They're beautiful magazines, well done. I think Oregon could be doing something like this. It would raise some of the issues of fish and wildlife. Having chaired this committee in the past, I know how much energy they've put into this, and I hope you'll take a look at it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Shields. Any comments? I think we'll be having a conversation with our...
Just information. Department. And, Madam Chair, for your purposes, I'd like to give you a copy of a couple more copies of these, plus a copy of the knockoff to take a look at.
Thank you.
Let's see the knockoff.
There you go. Okay. Any other business before the committee? Anybody have a comment out there? Well, before we adjourn, I want to take this opportunity to thank everyone for their participation on this committee. You all work very hard. And I also want to recognize and thank the service of two of the members who will not be returning to the legislature. This will be your last committee hearing, as far as I know, Senator Shields and Senator Starr. It's just been an absolute pleasure to serve with both of you. You've done well.
And Senator Ringo down here.
And Senator Ringo isn't. My gosh, our committee has three of the departing
all
members.
All three of the senators that are here.
So I do appreciate all three members' service, and I'm going to be disappointed to see you all go. I think you've all added your piece to Oregon history and what we do here, and I'm sure your constituents have appreciated your service as much as we have. And I wish you well. The committee wishes you well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right. Well, unless we have anything else, I see Kate Newhall down here. Kate, did you need us for something? Okay, great. All right. Well, committee, thank you very much. Enjoy your lunch. We'll see you this afternoon.